Commissioner Richard Rogers from, well, he's our hometown boy and our host. Also, Mr. John Carlson, who is our executive director. Also with us is our award-winning staff, Adriana Shea and Sherry Cole.
Sean Cubbage.
And with the representing the department today is Mr. Sankey Mastrup. And also, I'd like to thank Lieutenant George Gross for representing game wardens being with us today. And we have a nice audience here today, so let's get started, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you. First, a couple of housekeeping items. I'd like to let everyone know the restrooms are outside, right out the door here, and there's some vending machines. And I also would like to remind everyone that we're on live streaming video today, so all the speakers are being filmed, and then there's an archive recording of that available at a later date. You can get to it from our website. So just keep in mind that you'll be on camera today, and if you want to watch it later, you can get to it anytime you want through our website. Yeah. We'll start with item number one, public forum. Any member of the public may address and or ask questions of the commission relating to the implementation of its policies or any other matter within the jurisdiction of the commission. As a general rule, action cannot be taken on issues not listed on the agenda. Staff will normally be requested to follow up on such items at the discretion of the commission. Submittal of written comments is encouraged to ensure that all comments will be included in the record before the commission. Please be prepared to summarize your comments to 3 minutes today. And we'll start out with Chris Hefflinger, followed by Joel Greenberg, followed by Tom Hafer, followed by Paul Weakland.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Chris Hefflinger. I'm the sanctuary advisory commercial fishing seat holder for the sanctuary here. I'm also a fishery activist and have been involved in fishery management and politics for, going on about 10 years through a lot of processes. And today I want to talk about a paper that I have here by Hilborn, Aranzo, and Parma. It's entitled Institutions, Incentives, and the Future of Fisheries. I just want to read you a brief abstract. It says, fisheries around the world are managed with a broad range of institutional structures. Some of these have been quite disastrous, whereas others have proven both biologically and economically successful. Unsuccessful systems generally involve either open access, attempts at top-down controls with poor ability to monitor and implement, does that sound familiar, or reliance on consensus. Successful systems range from local cooperatives to strong governmental controls to various forms of property rights, but usually involve institutional systems that provide incentives to individual operators that lead to behavior consistent with conservation. Behavior that's consistent with conservation. And the key word here is incentive. And my question to the commission is, I look at what happened with the decision to adopt this preferred alternative. It's pretty costly to the fisheries. I'm curious if the commission understands that doing that creates a disincentive for people, fishermen, to be involved in management. And that is exactly what we don't want. And I guess the reason I'm here today is I want to make sure you understand that. There's a lot of people that are demoralized about what went on there. These guys put a lot of effort in to try to work in the system. And what happened was the system failed them. So I know there's still time to change things. This looks like a top-down. The governor said, do this. We're going to do it. And we're going to repeat failures we've already made. And like I said, I think it's a disincentive for people to participate in behavior consistent with conservation. I hope you'll reconsider that. Thanks.
Joel Greenberg.
Good morning, President Flores, commissioners, Director Carlson, and everybody else. My name is Joel Greenberg, and I'm the Southern California chairman of the Recreational Fishing Alliance down here. And I want to come forward, if I might, and hand you some documents real quick, and I hope that you won't take that out of my 3 minutes. It won't even take that long. I'll be brief because a little bit of what I would say Chris has already said. But I'd appreciate if you all have this document in your hand to look down on. This is a peer-reviewed, journal-published document, and it's entitled Seeking Consensus on Designing Marine Protected Areas, Keeping the Fishing Community Engaged. And I'm just going to read a couple sentences. It says, membership included representatives from resource agencies, environmental organizations, commercial and recreational fishing interests, and the general public. While the group agreed on several areas for fishing closures, members could not reach consensus on a specific network design. Several factors interfered with the group's effort at attaining agreement, resulting in the endeavor subsequently being replaced by a top-down approach that lacks the support of the fishing community. Lessons learned from the project emphasized the need for marine protected area participants to recognize irreconcilable impasses early in the process and to seek solutions to maneuver around them. Now, this is not about last week's decision. This is about the Channel Islands, and this was an exhaustive postmortem done by a number of scientists and compiled by Mark Helvey from NOAA. And there's some really excellent conclusions in here, recommendations on how not to go wrong, and I really have a fear that what is going on is that in spite of the fact that this was a good guidepost to how to do it right, we have been straying in this process. So as Chris said, there's still time to fix it. I hope you can. And thank you for your time.
Tom Hafer, followed by Paul Weekman, followed by Marshall Thompson.
President Flores, Commission, Mr. Cunningham. I would like you to reconsider some of the lines that you put forth on the proposals from 3R. I would like specifically a change at Big Sur to False Sur and to Big Sur Rock that will satisfy the sport fishermen out of Monterey and Morro Bay and the nearshore fishermen out of Morro Bay and Monterey. I would like a change at Piedras Blancas to Harlech Castle Rock, bring it south a little bit, so very small change. It'll still let the small boat sport guys fish in their favorite spot above the light when they can go above the light, and it will give a little more room to the nearshore fishermen. I would like you to look at the Cambria Marine Reserve off Cambria, maybe make it smaller, because with Piedras Blancas, Pouchon and Cambria and the sport park being all there together, it only allows us 3.5 miles of nearshore area at Point Estero. And the last change, I would like you to look at the Prisma area, bring the northern line down to the 34 line. That will ensure the deeper nearshore guys that have that permit will be able to keep that fishery open, because right now with that line at Prisma, how high it goes, there's about 40 permits in the deeper near shore between Morro Bay and Avila, and that's where they fish for the Balena. That will allow them still to keep that fishery open and operate that fishery. If you close that line, bringing it all the way up, how Package P has it, it will totally devastate and wipe that fishery out. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Tom, hello? Tom, if I may, do you have that written up?
John has those changes that we made in Monterey last week. And he does have them. I will send him the changes, though. He asked for them, and
thank
I will
you.
Send him the changes.
Yeah, I'd like to see them.
Okay, thank you.
This wasn't working.
Thank you.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. We would once again like to appeal to the Commission to please put the withering syndrome, the devastating abalone disease, on the agenda. What are you afraid of? What are you hiding? I have handed out handouts today. They're supporting documents showing the archaeology of California, showing no traces and evidence of any otter bones or otter parts ever found in any archaeological sites in California. We know that your scientists are hastily going back and rewriting history even more. I also handed out a questions and concerns regarding the San Miguel Island abalone accessory protocols. They say that the purpose of the San Miguel Island abalone assessment survey will determine an estimate of the abalone population density to be used to ascertain the status of recovery. That's wonderful. We applaud and acknowledge with much appreciation, admiration, and anticipation the effort to ascertain the status of the recovery. We really feel that the partnership that's being created and the bond that is being molded here for our abalone resource should be a success, as I've heard Commissioner Rogers and Commissioner Gustafson say. Well, we shall see. And these questions and concerns are all written out here, and we know that 8 copies are required, so we provided them, that all the appropriate people will get a copy, and that your job as commissioners are our liaison and our voice to the legislature, and that any information that we give should be disseminated not only to the people of California, but to the legislature. And we do not feel that all of these things are being done in a proper manner or prescribed method. And we would hope that every legislature learns the truths about our history so that they can formulate good, viable decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Marshall Thompson.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Marshall Thompson. I'm speaking as a private citizen right now. I've been a sport diver in California along the coastline from San Diego through Malibu for more than 30 years. And I want to comment in support of establishing and maintaining offshore sanctuaries for fish. My observations, strictly as a sport diver, are that since I started diving in 1969, the apparent population of sport fish and abalone, for example, have dropped considerably in my 30 years of diving here. In fact, there's areas along the coastline and around some of the islands that are so fished out that it has desert-like conditions. My own observations and studies have indicated to me that since 1900, the fish stocks of sport and your eaten variety kind of fish that are gathered commercially have dropped by 80 to 90%. Now, that's understandable when you look at the growth of the population here in the state since that time. But I want to commend you for establishing these offshore marine sanctuaries, and I urge you to consider expanding them. There's a direct benefit to the fishing community. More protected areas, there's more reproduction of those desirable species. Ergo, the fishing folk in other areas, the non-protected areas, will definitely have more fish to fish. So keep doing it. I applaud it, and thank you for an opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our public forum speakers. Go ahead, Eric.
Thank you. My name is Eric Mills, Coordinator of Action for Animals out of Oakland. Good morning, President Flores and members of the Commission. This is a great spot to have these meetings, except Motel 6 is $100. Other than that, great area. 3 items I'd like to address briefly in ascending order of importance. First of all, I wish in the future that the Commission might have public forum on both days of the meetings. Some folks can't make both days of the monthly meetings, and I think it'd be a real boon to the public if you could do that. Secondly, a small update on the lily pond problem in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, where, as you know, we have a population of African clawed frogs, 10,000 of them, according to Dr. Green at Stanford. They have an ongoing trapping program. They're getting about 200 frogs a week. what we just figured out money's worth. They're spending about probably $35,000 a year to do this. They have four employees working 4 hours every Tuesday, and then Eric Larson from Yountville has to come down to take them back there to euthanize. And he recently told our herpetologist, Paul Haskins, and some of the workers there that he felt maybe it was time to meet with the Rec and Parks Department in San Francisco and drain the pond, which we've been pushing for a little over 3 years now. So I hope you will use your influence to see that that happens. Lastly, I just handed out a packet about California's fish and game wardens. We're getting fewer and fewer, and we need more and more. As you know, CAWS just settled a deal with the wardens where they're going to get just a 10% raise this year and then another 15% in the next 3 years. But this still, it does not bring pay parity to the wardens. They're way behind California Highway Patrol. They get no backup. They get no overtime pay. They get shot and killed at three times the rate of regular highway patrolmen. They deserve better. I just got an email from one of the mucky mucks on the Wardens Association, said he knows right now 13 wardens who are going to resign very soon despite this new contract. So I put together a packet of items, one of which is a letter from a consortium of interesting group, California Farm Bureau, Defenders of Wildlife, Safari Club International, California Sportsman's Lobby, and others pushing for pay parity for the wardens. They're the last thing we got between the wildlife, and with the new marine sanctuaries, you're going to need more. I understand we have only 14 wardens along the coast now. Florida has 700. We got 192. That's not acceptable, and we're going to lose it all if we don't do better. Thank you very much.
Any other speakers for public forum? We'll move to item number two, recognition of Waterfowlers Hall of Fame and induction of six initial members.
Did you want to speak in public forum, Bert?
Yeah, I just got here.
Come on. Come on, forum.
Sorry.
Hold on, Bob. We're going to one more speaker, and then we'll get.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Vern Gehring with representing the California Sea Urchin Commission this morning, and I appreciate your indulgence. Airline schedules and drive times didn't allow me quite to get here at 10 o'clock. I just have a couple of brief things I want to share with you. As you may recall, occasionally I or somebody from the Sea Urchin Commission or Sea Urchin industry appears before you just kind of update you and bring you up to share with you some of the things that the industry is doing. And I wanted to just take a moment to do two things along that line today. I think you received a copy of newsletters that we sent some time ago. Maybe you received those already, so I won't hand out additional ones. But the industry is focusing their efforts on a couple of major fronts that they're that are concerned to the industry. And we, some of it is in maybe in the newsletter, but a couple of key areas we were working on is on the regulatory environment that the industry works on. We address those issues and work on developing new strategies and alternatives. We're working on the front of resource conservation and data collection to strengthen our base to and for conserving the resource and environmentally. And we're also working on promoting the industry in a general sense to educate consumer education programs and projects. One additional area that we're focusing on is to ensure high quality of sea urchin products in the marketplace. As you know, wasting wildlife taken in California either under commercial license or recreation license is a violation of law, and we think that ignoring the value and the quality of the product is just one way of maybe wasting some of that product. If the quality is not maintained, in a commercial sense at least, and degrades to some degree, eventually a product will be thrown away and it'll be wasted. So we've undertaken a program to maintain the quality. And I just wanted to hand the industry spent a fair amount of time over the last year analyzing their processes of their industry, from the harvesting stage to the transportation and the processing and the delivery to consumers. And we developed a fairly comprehensive list of best practices that would contribute to maintaining quality. And we've summarized them on this card. We've undertaken an educational process to train our divers and processors and processor employees of how best to maintain high quality. And we've put together this card to do that. And along with this, one of the main things that the industry has identified is the temperature control is a major factor in maintaining quality at various steps. And you'll see it if you skip down the 11 steps in our best practices card. So along with that line with quality control or temperature control, we've purchased thermometers that we've given to all of our divers to maintain as they can test and keep track of their own temperature control practices as they handle and deliver sea urchin product. One last final thing I want to just give you also is you'll recall earlier this year the sea urchin industry came to you with a series of regulatory proposals and presented those to you to make some minor changes in the regulatory structure. The commission decided to refer that to your Marine Committee, and we just wanted to ask you to not forget about that and to bring that up again in your Marine Committee at some point in time to discuss so we can go forward. We started a comprehensive program within the industry to do a thorough review of all the aspects of regulation dealing with the sea urchin industry, and we will be coming back to you at some point in time. And I have a letter on that issue I'd just like to deliver to you today.
Thank you.
Okay, that concludes that concludes public forum this morning. Moving on to item number two, recognition of Waterfowlers Hall of Fame and induction of six initial members, Dr. Bob McClandrews from California Waterfowl Association, and one of my former employers is at the, will introduce this item.
Thanks, John. Is that a warning? I'd like to thank the commission for entertaining the resolution that's before them. We're trying to establish a Waterfowlers Hall of Fame. The idea is to recognize individuals who have made outstanding and significant contributions for enhancing the status of waterfowl in California. There's been a group meeting now for the better part of 2 years, composed of past Fish and Game employees, Ducks Unlimited, California Waterfowl Association, and some folks that eventually probably should get into the Hall of Fame as well who are just adamant sportsmen. But we put together a collection of six names to initiate the Hall of Fame, which are on the resolution before you. And they are, and I'm going to give them in alphabetical order. Bob Eberhardt is the first one, who spent 40 years of dedication to waterfowl resources and was also president of Ducks Unlimited. Next one is Dr. Dennis Raveling, who's a professor of wildlife at UCD, really established research in waterfowl in California. He's a world authority and really brought the level of understanding and management of waterfowl up significantly while he was alive. Unfortunately, he died fairly young. He also was an advisor to Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, and really established the biological programs for the California Waterfowl Association. Number three is Bill Reedy, 35 years of dedication through California Waterfowl Association, and he was 2 years as chairman of the board for CWA. He was dedicated to the health and viability of the Sassoon Marsh and did a great deal to make sure that the Sassoon Marsh is preserved today. He's also instrumental in getting Ducks Unlimited into wetland conservation in California. Anybody who knows him knows his techniques were less than civil. he also saved the wetland reserve program from being lost to California because they couldn't deliver the program. And he challenged California Waterfowl Association staff to help out, which we have been successfully able to do, which meant about $50 million worth of conservation easements in California. So Bill was quite a character. Number four, Bud Reinecker, of waterfowl biologist for the California Department of Fish and Game. He fulfilled a critical role in banding ducks and geese for the better part of his career. He literally banded hundreds of thousands of waterfowl, which did a great deal to lead to our understanding of waterfowl in the Pacific Flyway. Number five, Harvey Sorensen. He's the co-founder and past president of Ducks Unlimited. He established the Harvey L. and Maud C. Sorensen Foundation, which to this day gives grants for conservation, but also for education and health as well, which are his passions. And finally, Joe Sweet, who also committed his life to waterfowl conservation through his efforts with Ducks Unlimited. That's the slate of six past exceptional waterfowl folks, and we hope to give them recognition today in passing this resolution. Thank you very much.
Well, don't go too far. I'm going to do this from the podium here, and I have a resolution from the Fish and Game Commission here, and I want to take this opportunity to thank those individuals and recognize them in a public way. And I'll read a portion of this resolution. It says, whereas the Waterfowlers Hall of Fame was recently established to recognize those individuals who have made significant contributions to enhancing waterfowl in their habitats in California, and whereas many professionals, both public and private, have dedicated their life's work in management or research in the field of wildlife biology, and whereas many sportsmen, agriculturists, and other conservationists have contributed to the restoration, enhancement, and preservation of our waterfowl resource by providing nesting and or wintering waterfowl habitat through agricultural practices and other land uses specifically designed to benefit the natural waterfowl resource. Therefore, it be resolved that the California Fish and Game Commission hereby recognizes the formation of the Waterfowlers Hall of Fame, and further be it resolved that we recognize the initial six members, as you stated earlier, and I won't state them again. So on behalf of the commission, congratulations to them. Congratulations to you as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McLandris.
Yeah.
Moving on to, we had no public speaker cards on that item. Item number three will be consideration and possible adoption of amendments to the migratory game bird waterfowl regulations for 2006-2007. And we'll start with the department presentation on their proposal.
It's migratory.
I did say.
You said migratory.
Good morning, commissioners. I hope this is a bit of good news for once. I know the last several meetings have been a challenge. On the waterfowl world, things are going very well for us right now. And what I'll do is very quickly review the department's recommendation, any relevant information we think might be useful to you. And if we can get the presentation up on the screen, it'll be easier. I'll start the discussion here. The We are under a liberal AHM package because of the good waterfowl populations and habitat conditions. Under a liberal season, they're working on the... Under a liberal season, we're allowed up to 107 days, a total bag limit of 7 ducks, a mallard bag of 7, a hen mallard bag limit of 2. We can open as near September 1st or September 24th, and we can close as late as last Sunday in January. And that is the package that has come out of the federal process. We'll get it up there real quick. Okay. Oops. As you can see, here are the various packages. We are under a liberal package because of good conditions, both in populations and habitat. So we have a tremendous opportunity or range. The department, based on this, is recommending the following. A 7-duck total bag limit, 7 mallards, 2 of which may be hen mallards, 3 scop, 2 redheads, 1 canvasback, and 1 pintail. Last year, for reference, it was a 7-duck, 5 mallard, 1 hen mallard bag limit. The goose limits vary by zone, but as you heard at a previous discussion, our goose populations are doing very good, and we're essentially increasing both the white front and large Canada goose bag limits in several of the areas from 2 or 3 and 3 to 4 per day total. The mallard bag limit is always one of intense interest by our waterfowlers. Again, the department's recommending 7 per day with up to 2 hens. Last year we had a 5 and 1. And for some background, it has ranged from 7 and 7 to 3 and 1. And some of those bag limits have been accompanied by change in season length. And as you know, a lot of things affect harvest, weather, et cetera, where the ducks are. So regardless of the bag limit, harvest varies in spite of our bag limits. Just as some background, this is a chart that shows days, and on the left-hand side you have restrictive, moderate, and under in liberal packages, and the years, what it equates to, and the bag limits, the number of years we operated under those, and then the range of mallard harvest. It's a lot of numbers, but you can quickly see that there's a tremendous overlap in bag, regardless of the bag limits and season length. So there's a lot of variability in the system, which is the point. Under harvest structures, under a liberal package, our harvest has ranged from 219,000 to 450,000 mallards with an average of 300,000. Under a moderate framework, you can see the range and the average and the restrictive likewise. The point really is to point out that there is overlap in the packages. And from a mathematical perspective, there's statistically really no difference, even though the averages do vary, and you do affect the average. The reality is, with all the noise, it's not a perfect system in terms of being able to really predict harvest. But on average, it works. The other issue, of course, that's always of intense interest when it comes to mallards is the hen harvest. And here's some data on the average hens per hunter per day under a, the graph on the right, under a 1, 2, and 7 daily hen bag limit. And what you'll be unimpressed with is the difference between them. It generally doesn't make a big difference. A huge part of that, of course, is our hunter behavior. Our hunters tend to avoid hen mallards anyway, so regardless of the total number you allow, they tend not to focus on harvesting hen mallards. Here's a, another way of looking at the information, the effect of a 1 hen per day bag limit, and the average harvest under a 1 and 2 day. And you can generally see on the graph on the right from 1970 to the first green line were seasons with 7, 6, and 5 hens per day. And then the period where there was a 1 hen mallard and then a 2 hen mallard. And you can pretty much see that there isn't much difference. The unless there's questions about that specifically, we can come back to that later. I'm now going to move to season length recommendations. Again, as a quick reminder, under the federal rules, we have to take the junior hunt days off out of the total of 107 of the liberal package. Therefore, that's one of the reasons you're not seeing 107 other than in the case for geese. So for the season length recommendations, we're proposing 105 days in the Northeast, 102 in the southern San Joaquin, and 101 on the Colorado River, and 100 days in Southern California in balance of state. Geese, 100 days in most of the state, and 107 days for small Canada geese in the North Coast, and that's largely because of our depredation control days we're going to be offering. Good news for brand hunters is we'll be proposing or recommending increasing from 15 to 30 days. This is, again, also the first year the feds have allowed us to split the season between the North and the South, which we believe is a nice piece of flexibility that the commission now has in adjusting. And our proposal is for the northern zone to begin the season the first Saturday in November, and then the southern zone, or Morro Bay, second Sunday in November. The youth hunt day recommendations are the same as last year, unless you have specific questions. They vary from 1 or 2 days. Northeast zone being the exception is that it's actually before the season as opposed to the rest of the zones where it's after the season. And again, that's just a matter of when the ducks are moving in. And you, it's a tough deal for a kid to be out there after the season in the Northeast. It's mighty, mighty cold. Here is a visual representation of the northeastern zone. The yellow line is the federal framework. That's what's maximum allowed in terms of start and end and total days. And one of the things we're also doing here is making a zone boundary change. And I'll zoom in a little bit. The existing zone boundary is to the right there. And we're moving it back to the historical zone boundary. It's a minor adjustment. We've been working with the local waterfowling community there, and they prefer to go back, and we don't have an issue with that. In the southern San Joaquin Valley zone, we're proposing a split in the general duck season, and starting a little earlier, the waterfowling community we've been working with would like to take a shot at waterfowl that are going, heading on through to Mexico before the our normal season start, and they want a chance to see if they can interact with them. The Southern California zone is a straight shot beginning October 21st. The Colorado Zone, River Zone, again, is under agreement with Arizona. We follow Arizona and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regulations. The balance of the state, October 21st through the end of January, or January 28th. And we have a special water white front season. Here's the black brant season recommendations. Again, the yellow is the federal framework. And then we have a slight earlier opener in the north, or Humboldt Bay, essentially, and the south, or balance of state, which is essentially Morro Bay. And again, a 30-day instead of a 15-day season. In case, I'm sure this will come up, some of our brant hunters are very interested in this subject. This is some history in terms of our state total objectives, or midwinter survey objectives, which we currently have 10,000. That's the upper green line, and that's the state goal. And then the lower green line is the one, the totals we've been seeing. So that there's generally an upward trend, and it's good news. And what the point you'll see here is part of the season adjustments that have been made in the past is to improve our midwinter indice counts. And that has been working. And that's it. Are there any questions? Good. And I will have to apologize that I couldn't have Dan Perigary here, and I'm sure he's cringing hearing me go through his presentation.
That was my comment. I mean, I certainly appreciate your presentation, but I sure like the color of Mr. Perigary.
Yes.
I'm disappointed he's not here.
We will try and avoid that in the future. Okay. So my apologies for my miserable Dan Perigary imitation.
Mr. Colleague, do you have a question?
I'd like to hear the public comment before.
Oh, yeah, we have public testimony. No questions?
Yeah.
No, go ahead, call the names.
Okay, we've got five names: Walt Manziel, Jason Joy, Gene Joy, Ted Romo, followed by Bill Gaines.
President Proy, members of the commission, department staff, Walt Manziel representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. We generally support the department's recommendations. We realize there's room for adjustment to suit various groups in various parts of the state. We don't have anything to offer on that front from our agency. We do support the Aleutian goose hunt in Del Norte County. We are concerned that to the greatest extent possible, this hunt be controlled by the department and not by the private landowners, that it not turn into a private hunt for their families, friends, and so on, that there be a realistic opportunity for unattached hunters to enter a lottery or something to participate in that hunt to the greatest extent possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Manziel.
Jason Joy, followed by Gene Joy.
Come on up, folks. There's plenty of seats right next to the podium, so you can get ready to speak.
My name is Jason Joy. Thank you for letting me speak today. My dad is Gene Joy and has taken me out hunting and trips on Morro Bay at our ranch. Last year, I passed the hunter safety course and got my first hunting license and deer tag. I came with my dad today and other friends to ask to keep hunting and fishing open in Morro Bay and Avila. My dad told me that people want to close parts of Morro Bay and Avila to fishing. I have gone hunting in Morro Bay and since I was 5 years old. I fish out of Morro Bay and Avila also. My dad told me one of the areas they want to close to fishing is the same place I caught 2 30-inch Lynn cod. They were so big my dad had to grab me by the legs because they were pulling me overboard. Please keep Morro Bay open to hunting and fishing in Avila too. Thank you.
Thank you. Gene Joy, followed by Ted Romo, followed by Bill Gaines.
I don't know how to follow that up. That's beautiful. My name's Ted Romo.
I'm
out of Eureka.
Actually, Gene's next.
Oh, okay. I heard Ted.
I'm sorry.
You've done a good job, Gene.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. I had a couple of different things. First of all, we support the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recommendation of the 30-day season. There has been an increase, definite increase in the brant population. I received an email, in fact, yesterday from a biologist that we support up in Alaska saying that the brant had a good harvest. He expects another increase in the population. So that's very positive. We're a 501c3 organization, and we've been using our funds to sponsor research in the nesting grounds because we felt there was a problem in that area, and that's that we went right to the base of it. So if you look at the telestrator, basically, I'll just go quick here. This is a, believe it or not, this there you'll see other pictures, but this is where the brant and other eiders and waterfowl have their young. But right now, you're looking at a snowfield. Next slide. Excuse me a second. Bob? Oh, you put them on. Oh, boy, that looks so funny. Okay, these biologists, you got to give them credit for it. I mean, they go out there in this barren area and set up a tent, and this is the way they operate. And it takes them 75 miles inland. They do. They come in with a snow machine, towing their equipment behind them. They invited me to come up this last year, and I said, man, it looks pretty cold. And they said, well, it gets down to about 40 degrees below zero. So I tried to donate. I tried to get somebody else to go, and they wouldn't do it. This here is prior to them setting up the tent. These old pieces of lumber and stuff were brought in. That's their platform. And you can, again, see what a vast area it is. Next. There's a big glare on his eye there. This is what we're trying to protect. That is a newly hatched black brant right there. Next. That one there still is wet. And they're just cute pictures. These are hard. It took us 10 years. We've been sponsoring projects up there for 10 years, and it took this long actually to get some real good information back from them and some actual photos. Next. This is a female brant defending her nest, and that's a typical defense posture. You can see that snow area that was once all snow now is melted, and this is when they migrate back up there. And it's a pretty barren area, so they're pretty acceptable to predators and also gulls and that type of thing. Next. This is a female brant, bandit, and there's only, you can see one little gosling down there. Next. Again, this is a newly hatched. There's a broken egg in the back, a pair of baby brant. You can see the water, which is a, like Morobay, it's like an estuary. Next. I'll be through here in just a second. This is a male brant and a female brant. Same little chick there. Same little gosling at the bottom defending it. So these are some really neat photographs to give you an idea of where these birds are raised and how remote the area is. And it's hard to get people to go up there and do these studies and increase the population.
You said you've been providing funds for 10 years?
Yes, since our inception.
How much would you say?
We generated over $300,000, and not all of it, as you know, not all of it's profit. But we supported Dr. Sedinger. He's a pretty famous biologist for quite a while up there in different projects. In fact, we indirectly supported him this year. We've been working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and also the Alaskan Natives, and it's taken a long time to put it together, but it's working.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, guys. Bye.
Thank you. Ted Romo, followed by Bill Gaines, followed by Eric Mills.
Ted Romo, excuse me, Eureka, California, North Coast Chapter, California Waterfowl Association. Good morning. I had the opportunity to come down in December and work with Mr. Gene Joy and myself, in which we started to accomplish something that hasn't been done here in California, and that was put both Humboldt Bay and Morro Bay together in an alliance. And I've written a note regarding this. Part of the problem here we have is what's good for the goose is not necessarily good for the gander, though. Yeah, okay, one man's meat is another man's poison. We have now been separated into just two zones, and although we have 30 days, the 30 days are not equal, okay? Humboldt Bay
will find itself basically losing approximately almost 2 weeks access to our population that is migrating through our bird show up around the 12th and 13th. If we start the 4th this year, and we start the first Saturday every time, we will fall back 4-3-2-1 and end up in the 1st of November. And the furthest we can move forward is November 7th. We will never go past November 7th, which means we will always end. December 6th is the last day that we can possibly hunt. But if our birds show up on the 12th, okay, which is normal, and I've written a letter regarding all this stuff and sent it down. I don't know if you guys got it or not. It means that we will be basically subjected to fewer accessible days, okay, as consumers, okay? And it's important to us. We have our supervisors. We have over 100 people who are very concerned about this. Part of the problem is, overall, if we present this to the future of our hunters, which we have a very small subjective area of hunters in Black Brant, we will be on an attrition basis. I'm 60 years old, okay? We don't have a large Black Brant hunting population that is going to be following me. And if I don't have an opportunity to give them the reason to go out there and say, look, there's a brant, would you have an opportunity to even shoot a picture of this brant? And they come back and they say, well, I'm 15 years old. I'm not interested in going brant hunting. It's more accessible, more fun to go for a goose hunt or for a duck hunt. And so I'm looking 20 years down the line. You could have something like Oregon and Washington. You have no brant hunters left. You can offer a season. But if there's nobody there to have take you up in your party, it's a lost cause. So I'm proposing that we have a compromise here, okay, from the first Saturday to something else, okay? And I'm looking for something that gives us an opportunity. I'm sorry about this. But we need to have an opportunity to work with these birds, okay? And either that could go to the first or the second Wednesday, okay? Or I ask for a fixed date, then I always have something to work with, okay? Otherwise, we're lost for the future, okay? It's not about necessarily hunting, okay, and the take. It's about who's out there and who's going to be the heritage, who's going to be the future of our sport. And I'll leave it open to your dialogue at this time if you have any questions.
Any questions? Okay.
I'd actually like to hear from the department about the dates, and if there is flexibility, and if not, why was it selected?
Thank you, Commissioner Rogers. The season structure we have for Black Brant, particularly in Humboldt Bay, is a compromise situation between what we had before, what folks want, and what we think is a compromise. While it seems kind of trivial, we've spent a lot of time trying to get a split season. We did go from 15 days to 30 days, so there is actually a net increase in days overall. It's going to look a little odd, quite honestly, to the feds if we argue for a split season and have identical seasons in both zones. We could probably explain it. We've worked very hard to get this flexibility because we may need it in the future. One of the graphics I showed you is we do have midwinter count objectives for Black Brant, and we've not been achieving them in Humboldt, and part of it has to do with how the birds are using the bay and how hunters interact with them. So there's been adjustments of when we have people out there hunting them to achieve our goals for Black Brant in both Humboldt and Morro Bay. You could move it back. I mean, it's not the end of the world. It's just what we presented you is a compromise between wanting to shoot more Brant. They will have more access. They will have 30 days now, and they will have Brant hunting. It just... I understand their point of view is you move it back, it will be better, or likely to be better. It's just we're in a rebuilding mode with Brant, and their good work is helping, and brant populations seem to be coming back. So it's one of those measured things. How far do we want to go? How fast? Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, I don't know if that totally answered your question, but it's a compromise if you want to.
Obviously, there was, actually I was talking to Dan, is there some threat that the feds would then come back and say, okay, well, you can't have a split season? Do we not have the ability to move on a sliding scale? These, you know, 1 year maybe the,
yeah,
the
I
numbers
mean,
dictate we have to do it this way. Other years we'll be able to.
Right. They're going to wonder, well, why did you argue for this if you have the same seasons? But we, you know, sometimes it will be the same. That's not necessarily a problem. It just, they haven't been, they weren't real happy about this to begin with. So it's, you know, it's a trade-off. If you want to move it back, you can. It's, like I said, it's not the end of the world.
Thank you.
Well, I'm a little confused. I was hearing the gentleman say that the opportunity, given the birds arrive on the 12th or the 13th, is actually less with this season than before. Is that true? Did I hear you right? Whether we went to 30 days or not.
It's true.
I'm not sure on that.
Yeah, well, see, that to me is the crux of the matter. I mean, you know, here we expand to 30 days, but given the actual opportunity for the ducks, it may be less, or not ducks, it may be less.
Less.
And that's awkward to me.
What are your peak, when do the brant arrive?
Our brant start to arrive between the 12th and the 13th is where we'll actually start to see brant on a reasonable basis, okay? Like I wrote in my letter, they don't work by our calendars,
sure.
Okay? They're a lunar bird. Okay, so I was trying to be very fair about this whole scenario and take an average. The birds usually end up around their 12th and 13th. Our biggest potentially birds start around the 16th in all reality. Okay, and for many years, this season worked for both Morro Bay and Humboldt Bay. And then suddenly they came up with this split. Okay, and it really creates some conflict, although it adds a little bit of ability to, what the word is, manage. It makes them very easy to micromanage us too, okay? And it isn't necessarily a great thing. In some areas I don't want to necessarily dive into, but we need to keep in mind of where we're going, what's the future of this particular area. We have approximately 45 people, okay, that are dedicated brant hunters. And I look at those guys out there and I say, out of those 45 people, I may have 10 that are in their 30s, okay? I look at Justin here, okay, Jason, and where's this kid who's going to take him out to be a brant hunter, okay, in 20 years because of this season that you guys want to set is the final crux, okay? It crashes us because that's what's going to happen. Okay, there will be no incentive. Okay, there was nothing out there for you to go look at. If you go into your catalogs, you look and find out how many brant decoys do you find out there and people are actually giving people, okay? It's all ducks and geese, brant.
What, if I could, what happens from the 3rd of December to the 10th of December?
What happens from the 1st to the 3rd?
Yeah, what sort of harvest? Is that the peak of your harvest?
No, our peak is from... I'd say a peak is from the 16th to the 30th, okay? And that's why we chose the 10th, because it was a moderation. Everything we do up there is moderate. We don't want to go into December 15th. We want to stay as far away from that particular number as we possibly can. That's why we went back to the 9th, okay? We had an opportunity to go to the 15th, and we have Greg Susie and Jimmy Smith, and they're all biologists, and okay, and they work in this stuff. We're very concerned. We originally started this whole season 20 years ago. Okay? We're up on this stuff. So, you know, this is moderation for us. But it also takes out to the fact that if we don't have the front end, we don't have a future.
Let me ask you this question. So are you advocating then that we don't do a split season ever again? I mean, what would then... I'm looking at that calendar. Mm-hmm. If historically your peak period is around the 12th, 13th, or 16th,
mm-hmm.
It's covered.
It's covered. Mm-hmm. But you can give us a season that starts in June, okay? And we cover that season too.
No, but see here, I'm trying to figure this out here.
Okay, sir.
We've asked the feds for a split season. Mm-hmm. We've got a little bit of one there. I think you're okay still within that time frame. And I mean, I'm not opposed to making it the same as Morro Bay and telling the feds, what? You're going to have to work with us. Okay, some
excellent
years.
Excellent idea.
Okay, but I'm looking for what is a scenario at some point historically that would say, okay, I need a split season. Is that when we
go to... Here's your historical thing.
Is that when we get cut back to like 15
days
again? 15 days. Okay. That's what I wanted to know.
Exactly. Right. And that's where it comes into some credence. But, you know, both bays work the best working together. We were very happy together working from the 10th to the 9th. And if they were happy working from the 15th to the 30th, so would we be.
So if we change this to the 11th, the same, or the 10th, the 10th is what you're advocating?
Yes, sir. It works for both bays perfectly.
We still have a split season
by
1 day.
Yes, sir. We both have a split season. We'll take the second Saturday. They can have the second Sunday. It's perfect.
Okay. I get it. Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Mr. Gaines.
Hang on a second. Okay. Sankey.
Can I add a few things? Because we've glossed over a few key points. One is their primary hunt period is covered by the season.
Right.
Okay, so I'm a little confused of what they just want more time. I don't blame them. That's nothing wrong with that. But this is important. What you see here, and I didn't do a very good job of explaining this graphic, we actually have management objectives for Brandt. And they're based on midwinter survey indices.
Well, it looks to me, Sankey, as if the Morro Bay Brandt are very close to their management goal, but the Humboldt are not even close.
Exactly. And that's, if I can get this thing to work without blinding myself. What you can see there under Humboldt, the dotted red line, the solid red line is the objective. We made some adjustments in season lengths to improve our midwinter indices in the early 90s, and it has been working. And thank you. I've got another pointer here. Not showing up. It may be too far. Morro Bay is there. We've got good midwinter surveys, and they're meeting objectives. Humboldt is still far short. And so part of the strategy for the split season is to try and improve our indices because they are dictating our management strategy. So I didn't totally cover that the first time. I hope that clarifies one of the reasons we're proposing this compromise.
So you're saying those additional days are going to drive harvest up? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they tend to harvest more later in the season. There, it depends. I mean, it literally depends when the Brandt show up. When they leave, we can predict when they arrive. It's just when they leave is somewhat unpredictable. They're one of the more predictable waterfowl, actually. But
yeah, they're not losing their peak. So I don't understand how
it just the later you move, the greater the harvest typically is for Black Brandt.
But typically, the weather conditions in Morro Bay that time of year.
Right.
I mean, Humboldt Bay.
Humboldt Bay.
Are.
They have 30 days. The season covers the prime hunting periods. They can hunt. I mean, there are birds there well past that date. And we think it's a reasonable, obviously. And I don't disagree, you know, they would like more days. It's just because of the midwinter surveys, we're a little concerned about putting too much pressure on it in Humboldt.
Mm-hmm. Part and of the problem...
It's not the end of the world. I'm just explaining you our rationale.
Right. And we're also right in the middle of duck season at that particular time, too. So this is, you know, we really don't have any influence on this. There's 45 of us. I think they're kind of saying cause and effect here. Okay. We have no effect on this, period. Okay.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Gaines would like to chime in on this.
Would you like me to touch base on Brant first?
Yeah, actually.
Just quickly, as you'll hear me say in a moment, the California Waterfowl Association is supporting pretty much across the board, with one exception, all of the recommendations that Zonka provided.
Bill, would you this acoustics in here is really hard on me to hear, so could you get closer to that?
Closer? Sure.
Yeah, I think.
We have our Regulations and Traditions Committee, which I'll talk about momentarily, but I will tell you that the Humboldt Bay Black Brant Hunters nor the Morro Bay Black Brant Hunters are currently represented on that committee. The California Waterfowl Association Board did support the Department of Fish and Game's recommendations that you see up here as far as the Humboldt Bay Brant season is concerned, but that was done with a lack of information, certainly no input from Ted Romo as well. So I think some of my board is here. Unfortunately, all my board's not here, but I think that we would not have a problem if the commission were to accept the recommendation made by Mr. Romo.
Okay.
Okay. President Flores, members of the commission, commission staff, and Department of Fish and Game staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I'm here today representing the California Waterfowl Association. I have with me today, who was up here before talking about the Waterfowlers Hall of Fame, Dr. Bob McLandris, who is the president of the California Waterfowl Association and who is one of the foremost waterfowl biologists in the nation. So if you have any detailed scientific questions that you'd like answered, Dr. McLandris would be more than happy to answer those for you. I'd like to talk a little bit about the California Waterfowl Association's process before I get to our detailed recommendations. I mentioned our Regulations and Traditions Committee moments ago. The R&T committee, as we call it, is a carefully designed committee made up of stakeholders. It's made up of hunters representing all the zones in California and also representing those that hunt the public lands as well as those that hunt the private lands. California Waterfowl Association has made every effort to do its due diligence in coming to the recommendations that I'm going to bring forward today, including working with the R&T. But before we get to the R&T, which we actually call together in the June timeframe once some of the waterfowl population, data is available, we work with the Department of Fish and Game and the Fish and Wildlife Service literally year-round in trying to quantify the health of the waterfowl species, both within California and Pacific Flyway, as well as mid-continentally as well. We do not take these recommendations to the commission lightly. Again, we do our due diligence. We work very, very hard to come to a conclusion and a recommendation that we can provide to you today. Having said that, I am pleased to say that the California Waterfowl Association does support the Department of Fish and Game's recommendations for bag limits as well as season dates across the board with one exception. That exception is the hen mallards. They are calling for two hen mallards. California Waterfowl Association is recommending only one hen mallard. I'd like to talk a little bit, if I could, today about the science. Extensive surveys throughout the mid-continental region have shown that the mallard populations, the mid-continental mallard populations, this year are right at their long-term average. The mallard populations are healthy on a mid-continental basis. A little bit closer to home, where the majority of the birds that we harvest here in California are raised throughout California, British Columbia, and Oregon, where these birds come from, the mallard populations are even healthier. They're above their long-term average. We're 26% higher than last year, and it's our fourth highest local, if you will, waterfowl population over the course of the last 15 years. The science says seven mallards. Fish and Wildlife Service framework recommends seven mallards. Department of Fish and Game agrees with seven mallards, and California Waterfowl Association agrees as well. This commission was created by the state legislature many, many years ago to make decisions regarding our natural resources based on science. Myself and my staff sit in front of many, many legislative committees throughout the legislative session, arguing on legislation that deals with our natural resources that should not be dealt with in our state legislature, but rather should be appropriately dealt with here in front of the commission. Our primary argument when talking in front of those committees in the state legislature is that natural resource decisions should not be made within the state legislature based on emotions, but should be made appropriately here in front of the Fish and Game Commission with those decisions based firmly on science. We believe that the commission is to sway away from making decisions based on science. Not only does it hurt the credibility of the Fish and Game Commission and its integrity, but it certainly sets us up in the long run for challenges from other folks who want to take issue with some of the decisions that are made
by the commission. If we continue to make those decisions on sound science, I think we do not leave ourselves open to attack from from others. Having said that, we do again support all the recommendations the Department of Fish and Game has laid out, including a 7-mallard bag limit. We do take exception on the hens. We do recommend one hen as opposed to two. If there's members of the commission that want to show some conservatism in regards to the mallard harvest here in California, we recommend that you reduce the hen take from 2 to 1. You saw the chart that Zonkey put up on the screen just a few moments ago that shows that there actually is a slight decrease in the harvest of hens if you lower the harvest or the daily bag from 2 to 1. If you go from 2 to 7, interestingly enough, there's very little difference, and that, of course, is because the hunters typically will pick out the drakes. They prefer to avoid the hens anyway. Well, I'd like to talk about one more point, if I could. Mr. Latham mentioned the northeastern Aleutian goat depredation hunt. That is something that the California Waterfowl Association very strongly supports as well. He did make the comment that they would prefer to see the unattached public hunter, if you will, have an opportunity to hunt some of those private ranches up there where the geese are flourishing. I'm pleased to say that the SHARE program, the Shared Habitat Alliance for Recreational Enhancement Program, which this commission and President Flores have supported so strongly in the past, has been working very hard on signing up landowners for the SHARE program for the course of the last 2 months. I'm pleased to say that we have nearly 20 private landowners who have agreed to participate in the SHARE program this year, and the intent of that SHARE program is to get public hunters access to private lands. And there will be a lottery, and any hunter can put their name in that lottery, and California Waterfowl Association and the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance will be releasing a lot of information in the very near future on how the public hunters can apply for that SHARE program. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. If you've got any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them now, or Dr. McLanders can answer them as well.
Okay. All right. Mr. Mills?
Thank you.
Good morning again. Eric Mills, Coordinator of Action for Animals out of Oakland. I have no real problems with the regulations as proposed either, but I would like to say a few unkind words about roboducks and electronic duck decoys. I'm not a hunter, but I'm not an anti-hunter either. I believe if you kill it, you eat it. You do it ethically, legally, humanely. And it's the ethically part that I have problems with. When I was a kid, I spent a lot of time reading Argosy and Field and Stream and Sports of Field and Outdoor Life, Esquire, those hunting stories. And every one of them, without exception, as I recall, dealt with ethics and fair chase. And I don't think the roboducks do that. As you're probably well aware, back in 1937, Pennsylvania banned all electronic devices like this for ethical reasons. Oregon and Washington did a couple years ago. Only last year, Arkansas has done so. Now Montana's pushing for it. I just had a little flash this morning. Been a lot of bad news lately in the press about sports and drugs in the Tour de France, track, baseball, football. It's a form of cheating. I know there are many decent and good people who use roboducks. Probably about 50% of the duck hunting population does use them, but I think it's a real ethical issue. It's very controversial, but I think to win the hearts and minds of the public, who is very much opposed to this, and as the demographics change, you're losing a lot of hunters. And look around the room here, we're getting a little long in the tooth here. I'm glad Jason's here, put it a little in perspective. But if this kid wants ducks, Brant, to hunt in the future, I think we're gonna need to take some strong ethical chances and set a precedent for much of the nation. So I hope in the future this commission will consider a ban on roboducks and anything similar. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. Chair would like to move the department recommendations.
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Next item.
Next item is item 4, update on the California Condor program by Jesse Grantham, California Condor Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Do we get to eat those? Or what? Oh, I thought they were clams. Oh, the condor.
Good
Mr. President, that's me. Before we go on to the next item, I just want to make a comment. This is the first time in all the years I've been on this commission that that the department has done such a good job that we approve the recommendation unanimously like this without making changes. And I want to commend Dan Paraguay for his excellent work with the feds on this and the department for coming in with a recommendation that was satisfactory to everybody. So good job. I just didn't want that to go by without noting it.
Good morning, Mr. President, Commissioners, Mr. Carlson. My name is Jesse Grantham. I am the coordinator for the California Condo Program with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I am also the team leader for the field program. And I'm here today to give you an update on the Condo Program and to ask for your renewal of our Memorandum of Understanding, which will give us another 3 years of opportunity to continue our research and recovery efforts on the California condor. I'll try to make this as brief and concise and non-rambling as possible, so we'll move through it pretty quickly. For those commissioners that were not present in the 1980s during the significant controversy over whether to bring the birds in or leave them out, or whether to have a hands-on program or a hands-off program, I thought I would just touch briefly on the recent history. We are now at a quarter century of recovery effort on this species. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Audubon entered into an agreement in 1979 to begin a research program to try and save the California condor. This was our last-ditch effort. The greatly expanded effort started in 1980, and by the fall of 1982, it was determined that the wild population stood at 22 individuals with one bird in captivity. Eggs and chicks from all wild breeding pairs were taken into captivity to start a captive breeding program in 1983. The wild population continued to drop, and by 1986, it was decided to bring all remaining birds in the wild into captivity. At that time, there were 27 birds in the world population. Captive breeding was a great success, and all wild birds brought into captivity became breeders. The first releases of California condors back into their historical range occurred on January 14, 1992, almost 5 years after the last bird had been brought into captivity. The first birds released were first-generation offspring produced from original wild birds. Since our last appearance before the Commission for the renewal of our MOU in August of 2003, the total condor population has increased from 215 birds to 290 birds today. The wild population in California has gone from 39 in December of 2003 to 61 through the middle of August 2006. The Los Angeles Zoo, the San Diego Wild Animal Park, the World Center for Birds of Prey, and the Oregon Zoo continue to hold breeding age adults for reproduction. 106 condors suitable for release or as part of the captive breeding program have been produced in the breeding facilities over the past 3 years. Since the spring of 2004, 18 condors have been released into the wild in California. Overall, there have been 127 condors released in California at four different release sites. These include Hopper Mountain National Wildlife Refuge, the Sierra Madre Mountains behind Santa Barbara here, Big Sur Wilderness Area, and Pinnacles National Monument. 46 of these released birds have died. 18 have been returned to captivity for behavioral reasons. Of the 46 birds that died, 10 died of collisions with power lines, 5 to unknown causes, 4 to starvation and dehydration, 3 to lead poisoning, 2 by drowning, and others from complications of a gunshot wound, cancer, ethylene glycol poisoning, and pulmonary edema. 18 birds, actually that should be 18 instead of 19, are missing with no known causes of mortality. Since the creation of a self-sustaining population within the condor's historic range in California is a major goal. Observing and documenting breeding effort within the state is of significant concern. We monitor all nests and all breeding activity throughout the breeding season. Our reproduction in the wild has been less than we had hoped for by this date. Since 2001, there have been 17 eggs laid in the wild in California. 11 chicks have hatched, while to date only one has survived to fledging. 9 chicks were recovered dead. This is a photo of the contents of the stomach ventriculus of a young condor that was still alive, it recovered alive from its nest full of human detritus, trash, bolts, nuts, washers, bottle caps. 7 contain significant amounts of microtrash in their crops and ventriculus. This is a young bird. This was that young bird in surgery at the Los Angeles Zoo removing that microtrash from its stomach. To the extent it may have contributed to or been the cause of death, in this case, emergency surgery saved the life of the chick. 1 other died from West Nile virus. 1 fell from the nest and broke a wing. This was this chick that had all the trash in it also. And 1 fledged. Of 4 nesting attempts this year in California, there is only 1 chick surviving, and only through heroic efforts has it been saved. This was taken about 3 or 4 days ago of a young condor in a nest being fed by its parents or a parent. The issue of microtrash is a major concern, as it appears the adults ingest this human detritus and bring it back to the chicks, where it is passed on during feedings. It appears that very young condors are unable to regurgitate this trash as the adults do, and the trash passes on to the stomach and gizzard, where it essentially acts as a plug, and the chicks slowly starve to death. Food is unable to pass through to the stomach. The 1 chick remaining in the nest this year in California had to be removed from the nest in the wild on August 4th, driven to the Los Angeles Zoo, operated on that day to remove a wad the size of a baseball of animal hair, bottle caps, glass, and plastic from its stomach. It was returned to the nest the following day. This is actually a helicopter bringing the chick back in to the nest site. This is the helicopter. There's a guy hanging from a line, emergency search and rescue. This is the nest site, and the chick and the individual are being lowered to the nest so that chick could be put back into the nest. As I said, heroic efforts by the field staff and the professional staff of the Los Angeles Zoo saved this chick and allowed us to put it back in the nest to be raised by its parents and hopefully fledge into the wild. The ingestion of microtrash by the adults and subsequently fed to their chicks is affecting our ability to at least get birds fledged into the wild. Initially, it was felt the ingestion of trash was an attempt to satisfy a craving for calcium or to aid in digestion. Based on recent studies conducted on old world vultures in Europe and Africa, which have the same propensity to pick up trash, it may more likely be the lack of sufficient food. Increased food intake greatly decreased the amount of trash ingested by both adults and chicks in the study. To that end, we have increased the amount of available food to wild condors, and we have seen an increase in the number of feedings of the existing chick. What we consider abnormal behavior may now be considered normal behavior for captive-reared released condors with no original wild mentors. While generally condors are less attracted to humans than in their earlier stages of release, they do not consider human structures off-limits. While there have not been any condor mortalities directly related to condors in human structures, generally human habitation contains generous amounts of trash which condors find palatable, and trash has been implicated in, obviously, condor chick deaths. West Nile virus has now entered into the western United States and is of great concern. 1 chick died in the nest last year from West Nile virus before it could be vaccinated. And this year, 7 unvaccinated condors have died at the World Center for Birds of Prey in Boise, Idaho. All birds are now vaccinated in Boise. California birds have been vaccinated since 2003. However, the long-term prognosis for West Nile virus and condors suggests there will be a need for constant inoculation of new birds, and it may be sometime before condors can fly free without human intervention, especially with regard to West Nile virus. Lead poison always looms on the horizon as a possible mortality factor. Birds pick up lead bullet fragments from carcasses that they feed on. This is a condor that had died. These are shotgun pellets in the digestive system of a condor. Overall, we have had 3 birds that we identified in California as having died of lead poisoning since the beginning of the release program. There have been 9 chelation treatments with 7 different birds. Chelation treatments are given to birds with elevated lead levels, levels that it is felt could cause mortality. As a comparison, Arizona, where we're releasing condors in the Grand Canyon, has had 8 confirmed lead deaths and 2 highly suspected lead deaths. We feel the actual lead deaths in California have been low because of the heavily managed feeding program, but that feeding program has had its drawbacks as it concentrates birds in one area, affecting social hierarchy to the point where only dominant birds will breed. The food provided is stillborn dairy calves, which we feel may be lacking in certain nutrients. And the natural behavior of searching for food has been replaced by sedentary behavior in wild condors. Sorry, let me just go back. The placing out of carcasses is strictly to avoid the possible ingestion of lead fragments from naturally occurring carcasses. This is a deer carcass that had been shot adjacent to the Hopper Mountain National Wildlife Refuge and not claimed by a hunter and fed on by condors. It was subsequently retrieved by staff and radiographed looking for possible lead fragments, and you can see the small lead fragments in that radiograph. Lead poisoning was the leading cause of mortality in the 1980s in recovered birds. Of the 4 birds that were recovered, 3 were identified as having died of lead toxicosis. Let me turn this on here. 2 birds had small lead fragments in their digestive tract, and you can see a small lead fragment in the crop of this particular condor, which was dead when we found it in March of 1984. The 3rd bird had elevated lead levels. Of 214 blood samples taken since 1994 in Southern California and used in analysis for blood lead levels, 95 showed above background levels of 20 micrograms per deciliter. Since 1992, 3 birds, as I said, have been confirmed to have died of lead poisoning. This is likely to be a minimum estimate of mortality due to lead poisoning, as a number of birds simply disappeared and may have succumbed to lead. 7 birds in the throes of lead poisoning were saved by emergency chelation. 2 of those went through the treatment twice. The most recent death, condor death to lead poisoning, was 2 months ago in Baja, Mexico, where we have another release program. Radiographs show the 22 bullet slug in the digestive tract and after the slug was removed. The proceedings of the 2005 American Ornithologists Union Symposium on the California Condor held in Santa Barbara last year will address in detail the latest scientific information on lead and the California condor. The scientific evidence at this point strongly suggests lead from ammunition as a primary source of lead poisoning in California condors. 11 of the 13 papers identify lead as the single most significant threat to condors. 3 papers state that as long as lead remains in the food source of condors, there will never be a self-sustaining population. The most recent paper to emerge on condors and lead will be coming out in the Journal of Science and Technology, and it is titled, "Ammunition is the Principal Source of Lead Accumulated by California Condors Reintroduced to the Wild." From the Peregrine Fund, 1 paper has been published in the Wildlife Society Bulletin titled, "Bullet Fragments in Deer Remains, Implications for Lead Exposure in Avian Scavengers." They have 3 other papers in press, "Movements of Introduced Condors, California Condors in Arizona in Relation to Lead Exposure, Movements of Introduced Condors in Arizona After 5 Years as Related to Lead Exposure, and Survival and Reproduction of California Condors in Arizona." From the Arizona Game and Fish Department, a paper in the AOU Proceedings is titled, "Efforts to Reduce California Condor Lead Exposure in Arizona." Papers in the proceedings focusing on California and lead will be "Lead Exposure Among Reintroduced California Condors in Southern California," "Reintroduction of California Condors into Their Historic Range," "The Recovery Program in California," and "Limiting Factors for the Historic California Condor Population." Mortality has been high in captive released birds in California. 35% of the birds we've released have died. It is unfortunate that we did not act quickly enough to have original wild condors that had all the traditions and culture under which this bird evolved present in the wild when we introduced the captive bred birds. There were 8 original wild condors that were taken from the wild as part of the captive breeding program. 3 of these have been released back into the wild. One was shot and killed, one died of unknown causes, and one survives today in the wild. In captivity are four survivors of that original wild population. The ideal situation is to release these birds back into the wild in an attempt to recreate as closely as possible the original wild condor population. But the importance of these birds is so great, we would have to maximize their survivability in every way possible. We think as long as lead remains a threat in the environment, these birds can never be released, and the opportunity to save the original wild condor population that links with the Pleistocene decreases with every day as these birds in captivity grow older. If I were asked what we need to do to speed up the process and maximize our chances for success, I'd ask for more full-time staff, an x-ray machine so we can x-ray birds for lead ingestion, so we can x-ray carcasses that we find in the field to determine if they have lead in them and remove them from the field so condors can't get to them, and so we can diversify their diet, a non-lead bullet coupon or exchange program for private hunting clubs within the range of the condor, a tax incentive for hunters using non-lead bullets, a conservation tax write-off for retailers that sell non-lead bullets, and a non-lead incentive for hunters using Forest Service and BLM lands. The next few years will be critical. We are learning a great deal, and I think we are turning a corner on some of the issues that have been plaguing us. We have taken on the daunting task of essentially recreating a condor culture for a bird that is essentially fearless, curious, and highly mobile. We have saved the species, but can the species reclaim its place in Southern California? This could well be the next serious question facing us in the remainder of this decade. The California condor remains one of the most critically endangered birds in North America. Its present and future survival requires creative, innovative, intuitive research and management. Scientific knowledge remains the key. Anything less and there will be no recovery. Thank you for the opportunity to give you that update.
We have a few public speakers. Walt Manzel, Eric Mills, and Paul Weekland. Walt?
I would only like to pose a question someone could answer in the future or something, but I would like to know what the cost has been, what the investment in dollars and cents has been in the condor recovery program from all sources and all people involved.
Eric Mills.
Good morning again, Commissioners. Eric Mills, Coordinator of Action for Animals. I remember reading back in the 70s maybe, Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, and a paragraph in there is stuck in my mind, saying basically that most people in this country have never heard of the California condor, and many of those who have would pay money for the privilege of shooting the last one. I've gotten almost that cynical myself. I think most people in this country don't give a damn about wildlife or wardens or protection or the long term. People in this room are an anomaly, really, looking at the big picture. Mr. Grantham made a very telling case. I think the most obvious answer, why the heck don't we have a national ban on the use of lead shot for anything? We did it for waterfowl years ago. Duck hunters fought it, but it passed, and everybody seems happy with it. It's not just condors who suffer. Any animal, there's lots of secondary poisoning with lead. We well know the toxicity, but skunks and foxes, coyotes, ravens, eagles, vultures are also carrion eaters. Lots of wildlife is dying out there we don't even know about. So I'd like to see an across-the-board ban led by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and supported by this commission and the hunters in the state. Here we lose it all. I think that'll do it. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul Weekland.
Commissioners, Paul Weekland. The California condor is an indicator species. It indicates how well the economy, or the ecology rather, of California is going. But as Walt Manzel said, We're spending a lot of money on this, and it really needs to be accomplished. As I handed out to you, the ancient Indians in this area, the Chumash, held the condor in great esteem. And they have an altar in the Condor Cave high in the wilderness area here. And it's thousands of years old. And as you read along the Indian lore, they believed it as being an indicator species. And without the condor in California, there is really no hope for our ecology. Thank you.
Well, I have a comment. And thank you, Jesse Grantham, when he started, he made a comment that he was bringing the MOU forward for approval. Unfortunately, we do not have that on the agenda because we had not received the MOU in time for the agenda. What I'd like to ask is that the department, right now it sounds like the Fish and Wildlife Service has no major changes except the date change to renew the MOU. The department just received a letter to that effect, and they want to take a look at it. Then they would bring it to the commission for approval. So we'll be getting the MOU in the near future for commission consideration and approval. So I just wanted to make that clarification.
I would just like to ask Sankey that one of the recommendations was that, and I know every time this issue comes up, we ask the same thing, but we got a little more money now. And he said that with a little more staff and an X-ray machine, they could get some better data for us. Is that something that in the cards with the department at all?
Well, I can't make any promises. The department is interested in getting as much information to bear on this issue as possible because there are a lot of things going on. And the scientists, as you can see, unfortunately, these birds, it's a hazardous world out there for them, and they're dying for a lot of reasons. Certainly, lead has been an issue, and we're very interested in it. Unfortunately, because of pending litigation, I can't really speak too much more on the lead matter, but we'll be briefing you soon.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Moving to item 5, request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to amend Section 236, Title 14, CCR regarding the prohibit the importation of turtles and frogs for the live animal market. And Sankey had some comments on this.
Good morning, commissioners. As you are aware, we've been discussing this matter for a while. The department would recommend that the most parsimonious or simplest way to deal with this matter be actually to add the species of concern to Section 671. That's the list of critters that are prohibited for importation, which is really our primary means of control here. The department does not believe 236 is the answer or modifying 236 because it essentially refers to that section of the code or a section of the code in that section of the Title 14 basically is a list of animals the legislature and the commission has decided does not want imported. Once an animal is in the state, we do not regulate commercial sale for food. That is not one of our authorities. So if the commission is interested in getting in the middle of this, we believe modifying 671 would be the way to do it.
Mr. Cunningham, did you have any response or recommendation on that?
Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General, and I haven't had a chance to talk with the department and Mr. Mastrop ahead of time in looking at this suggestion of changing the possible regulation from 236 to 671. But I was hoping to work with the department to see if we could explore exactly how such an amendment to 671 would be phrased. For the most part, 671 identifies either families, sometimes genus, and occasionally even species, specifically singled out as prohibited in California, either the importation or sale. And I was trying to figure out how we could couch the language to address the questions of turtles and frogs that are being raised in this live importation market. I do understand that the importation market normally works with only a couple of very limited kinds of animals. A bullfrog usually is the standard frog that's being imported. I think there's only one or two kinds of turtles. But I was curious how we were, if the department would think 671 works, how we would draft the language to be specific enough to deal with those animals that are showing up in the live animal market.
There, as council knows, there is a very elaborate set of Title 14 rules on aquaculture and sale of domestically reared critters for sale. So anything domestic we could handle through those Title 14 sections, and those are all by permit. So I think we have a very good set of regulations to deal with domestic supplies. I think the issue, or we believe the really issue that's been brought before us, is the foreign supplies of some of these animals. And there, our authority and the commission's authority is very limited, or we believe is very limited, basically through the importation restrictions. And both the code and Title 14 do list all the way from family, genuses, to species. The trick, of course, for example, and something that will be difficult to deal with is if we, for example, red-eared sliders, I think is one of the animals currently concerned with in this situation. If you put red-eared sliders on that list, that means pet shops could no longer import them. They could get them from domestic suppliers through our permit system, but they couldn't import them either for pet sales. So there's some crossover, if you will, in other industries besides the food industry when you start dealing with 671, because it's a rather gross or very broad rule. It doesn't generally discriminate as to the motive for the importation. It just says you can or can't import.
Mr. Chair, if I might again, too. Mr. Mastrop, do we have a sufficient handle on the specific species or families or genus that we could, as staff, then assemble a 671 regulation that would focus on the species that we're discussing about live importation? I mean, I'm sitting here looking at the only discussion of turtles in 671 goes only right now to a family of snapping turtles, but what we're talking about here are other kinds of turtles. In fact, my guess is more than one, so we would have to be careful in crafting this language. And I think we may also have to work with you closely to craft the language for the frogs, because I think it's more than just bullfrogs. I think there are a variety of other kinds of frogs we're concerned about.
It is the department's assumption that if the commission approves going to notice, we would obviously have to, working through the proponents and the industry, figure out specifically what species or genus or family, recognizing that we may be just chasing species. For example, you could ban red-eared sliders, and then they come up with a different turtle to import for to replace it, and we'd be back in front of you with a different set of species. That is a possibility, but that's something we would look at if you ask us to go to notice in part of the development of the initial statement of reasons.
We have four public speaker cards. Madeline Bernstein, followed by Marshall Thompson, followed by Eric Mills, and Stephanie Pappas.
Now, hi. I'm Madeline Bernstein, and I'm here today on behalf, I'm the president of SPCA in Los Angeles. I'm also a member of the State Fish and Game Advisory Commission that focuses on humane treatment of wild animals, although I'm not here on their behalf. We've been dealing with the issue of these turtles in Los Angeles, both in the live animal markets and the swap meets and the pet stores, for quite some time. We wholeheartedly support a ban on the import, and how that's worded, even if it included red-eared sliders, wouldn't be a tragedy. We had a very large case where 2,000 turtles were imported illegally into California. They were taken from the wild, which was depleting the species in other states. In the catch that we got, there were bags and bags of dead babies that were too small for food. There were also snapping turtles, which were illegal, which the importer said that he could certainly get more money for those in the restaurants. And on top of that, there were a good portion of the lot of the 2,000 were dead and diseased, with diseases that would transmit to humans as well. He did all of this with a fake fish and game permit. While he was in jail, he was actually issued another permit by the department, which we, of course, stopped. Not only that, aside from the inhumane treatment of these animals, which is not the focus of today's meeting, all the diseases that we found in those animals pollute, they're not native to this state. So they're released by well-meaners who buy these animals from the markets and pet shops and release them into areas where they bring diseases to not only other fish animals, other reptiles, but mammals and birds who drink from the water supply. So they are causing a great deal of problem in terms of disease in California. Not only that, looking at the local raised animals presents a similar problem because, again, the animal's too small to sell to restaurants, get sold to swap meets, get sold to pet shops, but those animals, even raised locally, are handled inhumanely. The stress of this handling, the piling in the burlap bags, the piling of the animals one on top of the other, the mixing of diseases, the mixing of the dead and alive, end up in the exact same place. They end up back in your ponds, back in your waterways, and they're also polluting the water, you know, and other mammals and birds are, again, dealing with the domestic supply as well. It's no secret there are laws on the books that say you can't sell a red-eared slider that's less than 4 inches in diameter. There's a recognition of the fact that there are these diseases, and I would strongly urge you to ban the import of these animals as broadly as possible and then also try to regulate through state law the sale and distribution of these animals, because we get them all the time through law enforcement action, and they're not complying with the laws that we've enacted last time we had this discussion to try to reach a compromise with the merchants. They're still in violation of those. So it's not helping. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'm here. If not, I'm sitting down. Thank you.
Marshall Thompson, followed by Eric Mills, followed by Stephanie Pappas.
Good morning, Director and Commission members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you again. Madeline and I and my wife, Susan Tellum, are part of a community of people who are not crazy animal activists. We are largely involved in the preserving the welfare and humane treatment of animals. We're not raiding labs and that kind of thing. So I want to make a distinction between people who are crazier than I am. My wife Susan and I and Madeline have been working on this issue of trying to prevent the importation of turtles and frogs into California for the live food markets for at least 15 years. And I know that we all, and along with Eric Mills, and I know that we all commend you and encourage you to continue on this very enlightened path to ban the importation of these animals into California. Madeline has done a fantastic job in describing to you the ecological impact of these animals on our indigenous species, waterways, and such here in California. The other aspect of it that she touched on, and I'd like to elaborate on, is the very real public health threat to those that both consume the animals as food, as well as the children that I observe having these very small baby red-eared sliders bought for consumer amusement. If you go to places such as the Santee Alley, which is notorious for selling all kinds of animals, from the lizards to the red-eared sliders. You'll get the occasional illegal imported snapper and that kind of thing. It's in the Fashion District in Los Angeles. We've repeatedly complained about this because of the very real danger of having a salmonella transmission to a child. There's a number of other diseases, E. coli, that's very transmissible. And a lot of it has to do with the extremely inhumane conditions that these animals exist in the collection, transportation, and eventual commercialization of these animals in dealing with the public. So it's a real human threat as well as a threat to the environment. In congratulating you guys in the work that you've done, and we very much appreciate it, and the animals appreciate it, on resisting the importation of these animals, there was one issue that the deputy director brought up that was very... I'm not a person who's versed in the law. I have a rescue, American Tortoise Rescue. It's a 20-year-old national nonprofit where we have rescued more than 4,000 animals in the last 15 or 18 years. The issue is humane treatment of these animals, because when you see, actually, let me back up there. We were talking about the importation, but if you don't attack the sales aspect of it, and our deputy director mentioned that there is basically carte blanche. Once they get in here, the wet foot, dry foot thing, like our Cuban refugees, once the animals are here, there's no enforcement to be able to protect the public, whether they're recreational users or the food eaters, to protect them and the public health from these animals once they're here. So they get here by hook or by crook, and then suddenly they're legalized and are offered for consumption and for amusement. So I would recommend, along with commending you about the work that you're doing against the importation of these animals, to really take a close look at banning their sale for food consumption and for amusement. By the way, if you guys have educated yourself on what happens to these animals in the live food markets, it is horrific. I have personally witnessed animals being put through a bandsaw head first while they're fully conscious. So you know there's a requirement in these live food markets that the animals have to be killed humanely prior to being sent home with a consumer. So there are some specific enforcement issues. I know this is also a budgetary problem, but any law that's passed that doesn't have a provision in there for enforcement is essentially not a law in practical sense. So I urge you to continue on this enlightened path. I don't know anything about the 236 versus the 671 or the 515th, but however it works, please do something for the animals. Thank you.
Eric Mills followed by Stephanie Pappas, followed by Paul Weakland.
I'm probably the crazy person that Mr. Thompson was talking about. I've been working on this issue for about 12 years now, and nothing has changed for the better. I just handed out to the commission a report that Miles Young, former Fish and Game Warden, put together for us only this past Tuesday. He spent 3 months in the markets throughout the state talking with fish and game folks in other parts of the country about the problems. He too saw animals being cut quite commonly with the bandsaw in the markets, which is illegal, of course. If you do go to notice, I beg you to ban the sale as well as the importation of the animals, because if you don't, you'll have the same problem. On the way here today, I stopped at a beautiful little park about a mile from here, downtown Santa Barbara, forgotten its name. I counted 82 red-eared sliders in this one little pond. They all came to be fed, running anywhere from about 4 inches up to the full-grown adult at 8 inches. God knows where they came from. Probably the pet trade and the markets. So a ban would not hurt. Again, these exotic animals, the red-eared sliders and the soft-shell turtles, displace the native species. We have only one native freshwater turtle in all of California, the western pond turtle. We're about to lose it. We've lost, 95% of our riparian areas. As they go, so go the turtles. Mr. Young found that there are only 10 importers in California who bring in frogs and turtles. And none of these folks do just frogs and or turtles. They're doing lots of other things too, so it's not going to impact anybody terribly financially. Oregon has banned these things. The Eastern European community has done so. Mr. Young was 5 years a warden in the Bay Area. For 21 years, he was the lieutenant in charge of overseeing the markets. And I go almost on a weekly basis and have seen stuff that would, I used to have hair before I started it. It's all fallen out since, this nightmarish stuff. In this report, there are 8 necropsy reports we paid for on the turtles and frogs. And they again routinely show all kinds of parasites, roundworms, the bloodworms, salmonella, E. coli. That too has not changed. So when folks eat these animals, they're getting some serious health problems. SARS broke out in southeastern China, as you know, a couple of years ago, and markets almost exactly like these. Wild animals, domestic animals, cheek to jowl with the human population. It's just a disaster waiting to happen. Lots of birds in these markets, too. Look at the permits there at the end of the, there's a 17-page report in that packet I just gave you and about 40 pages of supporting materials. The permitting process needs a serious overhaul. You cannot tell how many animals are coming in, how many are going out, where they're going. None of them are signed. It's a disgrace and an embarrassment, quite frankly. We don't have a clue about the numbers of animals coming in. But Mr. Young thought at one time as many as 15,000 turtles coming to the Bay Area every week, all from the wild in other parts of this country. And another woman in Oakland a few years ago testified she imports into Oakland every week 4 tons of American bullfrogs commercially raised in Taiwan, where they have open public sewers running through the frog ponds. I told some of the merchants I'd sooner eat a dead rat than some of these animals. So it's mostly just large metropolitan areas in the country where we have large Asian populations where this is happening. But it's mostly old school does it. The second generation is not a problem, but people want the old country and grandma's recipes. But I think with some education, we can stop this. We help the environment. We certainly help the animals and maybe set a precedent for the rest of the country to stop selling their animals around the world. China has eaten all of its native wildlife thus far. So a ban on importation and sale would be much appreciated. Thank you. Thank
you. Stephanie Pappas, followed by Paul Weakland.
I'm Stephanie Pappas, a genetic and molecular... biologist and a turtle conservationist working in California. I'm here today serving as executive director of the Colonian Science Foundation, the president of the California Turtle Tortoise Club of the Valley Chapter, and the vice president of the Desert Tortoise Preserve Committee. The California State Wildlife Action Plan lists invasive species as a major wildlife stressor. In California wilderness, non-native species of turtles and frogs have been and continue to be introduced both unintentionally and purposefully by the public. Both these species are disruptive and alter native ecological communities and have a negative consequences for native species and the habitat that they live in. As a genetic biologist and an individual promoting ecological restoration in California, research, public education programs, as related to the conservation of California's only native freshwater turtle, the western pond turtle, Emmes marmorata, a species of special concern in the state of California, I urge members of the commission to ban the import of frogs and turtles for live animal food markets and the pet trade industry throughout California. This would be one small step, yet a very important action taken towards prevention and management of 2 major invasive species causing threat to wildlife diversity and critical habitat restoration in California. Scientists are specifically concerned with the introduction of non-native red-eared sliders, which have been introduced throughout California's waterways, largely as a result of escaped or released pets from pet owners. Red-eared sliders compete with our native western pond turtles for basking, habitat, food, and nesting habitat. Studies completed by many scientists have observed significant reduction in the western pond turtle use of the optimal habitat when red-eared sliders were present. Our native western pond turtles evolved without competition. They are shy and they're overwhelmed by these non-native turtles. Furthermore, the North American bullfrog is considered a predator of the western pond turtle. They target hatchlings in particular, but they can also eat juveniles up to 5 inches. The western pond turtle is not the only native species suffering from the introduction of bullfrogs and red-eared sliders. The California red-legged frog is a dwindling amphibian in California. It's a federally listed threatened species since 1996. While it's illegal to release non-native turtles and frogs into the wild, the public continues to do so, and the evidence is overwhelming. In 2004, a San Diego biologist set traps in 63 sites where western pond turtles live. Of 63 sites, only 3 sites contain no invasive red-eared sliders and other water turtles. They pulled out 263 non-native turtles and 100 native turtles. During the 2005 Ventura and Santa Barbara County Western Pond Turtle Relocation Project, which involved several conservation organizations and the Fish and Game Department, approximately 20 sites were analyzed, and 25% of these sites contain non-native turtles. Parks and golf courses.
Do you have a written item you can submit to us?
Yes, that
would be good.
I'm almost done.
Our
public parks and golf courses are full of turtles that have been dumped into our community.
We'll take it in writing, though. But thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Paul Weekland.
Commissioners, Paul Weekland. We do not believe that the importation of foreign species into California is warranted. We have many examples of horrendous problems that have occurred. We'd like to speak about the abalone, how the cybeled worm introduced from South Africa is a devastating problem hindering the growth of abalone, not to mention diseases such as withering syndrome, and the fact that the imported species not only devastate from the introduction of parasites and diseases, but it also fouls the genetic reservoir and the gene pool of our natural species. We know that there's a mechanism in nature when there's too much genetic diversity present, large die-offs occur. It's nature's method of cleansing and purifying itself from all these introduced species. And this continually happens. And just like the cybeled worm and the abalone introduction, which we asked you not to allow the live importation of abalones, you did anyway, and now we are reaping the rewards from these decisions. Hopefully we can do better in the future. Thank you.
If there's no discussion by the commissioners, I have a suggested motion.
Questions, if that's okay. By and large, I support that we want to ban the importation of these animals. I do have a couple questions on the history. I do appreciate the narrative that we were given relative to the issue leading up till 1998. It appears that, or I'm sorry, 1999. Was AB 238 enacted at that time?
You mean as an implemented?
Did it become law?
You know, I'm not sure if it became law.
We have a great narrative on this. That leaves it with, we can still ban the importation, but were the other sections of it implemented?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, say that again, the question. I didn't hear it.
The question was implemented. I'm sorry, do you want me to repeat it?
No, that's all right.
Yeah, the gist of it was the bill did attempt, if I recollect correctly, attempted to ban the importation and sale, and during negotiations that was removed from the language and it did not go into law. It essentially didn't change much, if I recall right. Currently, the department does not believe it has, it's a resource management agency. Our authority is for managing natural resource issues. And our perspective would be simply, legally, we believe our only venue here is the risk to native habitats and wildlife. We do not do food. That's not our authority. So we have to be very cautious about how we deal with this issue, and one of the speakers did bring up some very legitimate concerns about the importation of some of these, whether it's disease or competitors with our native wildlife. Those are legitimate reasons for the
Absolutely.
Department to engage the issue. We don't get into cultural issues when it comes to food. We have no authority.
You can regulate sale by the permitting restrictions, right?
Yes, and that's only because we regulate the aquaculture industry. I mean, that is the one exception to that previous statement, is if, because, again, of the potential risk to natural resources, that is the reason we regulate aquaculture industries, because of fear of contamination and introduction of exotics.
Well, I guess what I was getting at in particular was that the commission apparently had quite lengthy discussion and department actions, even legislature getting involved in this back in 97, 98, 99, and then it was dropped, and the history ends at that point in our narrative. So I just wanted to find out what were the politics behind that ending at that particular point in time.
I could talk to you about that off, at some other time.
Okay.
That means it was from a former administration, I suspect.
No. No, we weren't in there.
Just kidding you.
No. It was.
He was laughing as he said it.
I personally am very interested in the banning of the importation of these things and the banning of the sale. And I realize that's not our ability to do that, but maybe we could do it by making permit restrictions for the sale of these things very, very difficult, very, very particular. I would like to see the department move forward doing this.
Right, and I agree with you, Commissioner Rogers. I was just trying to get an understanding of why it was dropped at that particular point in time, because it seems to me clear that we should have taken action at that point. But all that being said, I'm certainly supportive of it today. I think my final question was relative in the narrative. The agenda item calls for an amendment to Section 236, Title 14. Now the department today is suggesting that that's incorrect. We should be amending 671. We don't have that information.
I think he'll address it.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you. Then that's my only other question.
And to clarify, we would actually ask that you add 671 to the list of sections to consider. We're still interested in looking at 236. We just think there's limits to what we believe.
That.
Yes, the
so
commission
we
wants.
Were add 671.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I feel like I need to say something here because I'm the one that's got the ball rolling on this. I was around in 97, 98. I was then chief of staff to the lieutenant governor, so I'm aware of the issues and sort of what the political ramifications were and how it came about to hit a brick wall. But my intention originally was to hold public hearings on this issue, then come back to the commission and make recommendations as to what we ought to do. And we sort of got the cart before the horse, I think, here. I'm willing to go ahead and move ahead and go to notice, but I thought my original intention was to hold hearings first, then come back to the commission and go to notice, okay, here's what we need to do. Here's, after we've had several hearings on this, this is sort of the course we ought to take with the department's help and all the various constituency groups in place. My fear going this route is that we are going to send off some maybe some alarming signals and maybe signals that don't need to be sent. That's a concern I have. So,
I appreciate your concern, President Flores, and I hold the same concern. I don't think we want to go off on the wrong track. On the other hand, I don't think we want to bog down on this.
No.
This thing's gone on for way too long. What we do require is public hearings. If we can go ahead and move and go to notice, then conduct our public hearings, at least that we have put a framework around the public hearings and focuses people on the fact that we fully intend to do something about this, we need your input.
Yeah, we need to be careful as we move forward on this that that this is going to be a, all stakeholders are going to have a voice in this, and we're going to hear everybody, and we'll move forward based on a collective agreement, if you will. Okay?
And certainly we can add to the public hearing schedule and hold additional hearings, and I think
Absolutely.
That was your intent when this was raised before. Okay.
Well, I move then that we go to notice. We would, pardon?
I think you have some specific language that you can then...
Do you have some specific language that we need to amend?
Have that suggested. Are you ready for that? Yeah, go ahead.
And this is designed to capture everything. The suggested motion is Fish and Game Commission hereby authorizes its staff to publish notice of commission intent to amend sections 236 and or 671 and or any other Title 14 section deemed needed by staff to accomplish the prohibition of importation of turtles and frogs for the live animal market.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And just a comment, this does not preclude us, this does not stop us from having outside hearings if the commission wants.
No, we're going to. That was the whole idea, the whole intent. Okay. Yeah. And what time is it?
12:20.
We're doing okay?
Right now?
Yeah. Okay. Folks, I'm going to take a 10-minute break, and we'll be back at 12:30. You're on TV. We're live. All right. Mr. Carlson, we're going to take and move an item number 9 up to out of sequence. We're going to move item number 9 out of sequence. Bring it up now. Mr. Vern Blyke. He's trying to make sure that the presentation is ready to go. We'll take item number 6 up after that.
This is item 9, update on Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep Program by Dr. Vern Blyke of the Department of Fish and Game.
Thank you, President Flores, members of the Fish and Game Commission. Pleased to be here this afternoon to update you on the current status of the Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep Recovery Program. Okay. A few wildlife conservation programs have engendered as much public interest as the recovery and the restoration of Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep. These unique ungulates, or hoofed mammals, occur only in the Sierra Nevada and are endemic to California. Early in 1999, Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep were listed as an endangered species by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. and the California Department of Fish and Game agreed to lead the effort to recover bighorn sheep populations to stave off extinction. At the time of the listing, there were approximately 125 bighorn sheep in the Sierra Nevada. Today, the number of bighorn sheep in the Sierra Nevada approaches 350. The recovery program or the recovery plan has been prepared, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is in the process of circulating it for a final review. Preparation of this final draft has been a time-consuming task, and it involved participation by numerous stakeholders and other interested parties. Among the stakeholders are agencies that are partners in the restoration effort, including the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, National Park Service, and the Department of Water and Power from Los Angeles. A number of non-governmental organizations, including those representing conservation groups and grazing interests, also participated as stakeholders in the participation of the plan. The plan recognizes a number of necessary actions for restoring bighorn sheep in the Sierra Nevada, such as decreasing mortality rates from predation, minimizing the potential for diseases to impact bighorn sheep, habitat improvements, and translocations of bighorn sheep to vacant but historical ranges within the Sierra Nevada. A common philosophy among personnel charged with restoration efforts not only emphasizes the protection and management of bighorn sheep, but also includes a strong investigative component. Understanding why bighorn sheep declined to precipitously low numbers in that mountain range is as important as developing ways to reverse the downward trend. Personnel working in the program to restore these bighorn sheep are striving to better understand the interrelationships between bighorn sheep, mule deer, and the primary predator of both of those animals, the mountain lion. We are also placing a strong emphasis on understanding diseases and their effects on bighorn sheep populations, as well as developing an understanding of the genetic structure of the various populations of bighorn sheep in the Sierra Nevada. All of these interrelationships, including the effects of predation, diseases, and potential competition with other native ungulates, are confounded further by weather. And weather is the most important force influencing the availability of forage and ultimately determines how populations of ungulates and their predators perform. We have placed a strong emphasis on understanding the role of forage in driving the dynamics of mule deer populations that occur near areas that are occupied by bighorn sheep. And much of what we have learned and that is applicable to understanding these relationships in the Eastern Sierra Nevada ecosystem has resulted from the long-term investigations carried out in Round Valley, located near Bishop, California. But that effort has been ongoing since 1991, and it is yielding unanticipated results with respect to the ecological relationships among Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep, mule deer, and mountain lions. Further, we have placed an emphasis on determining the role of predation in driving the dynamics of both of these large animals. Dr. Becky Pierce, who oversees efforts to limit predation on Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep, cannot be with us today, and I will be providing some additional insight into that phase of our efforts a bit later in the program. If the opportunity to restore these magnificent animals to the Sierra Nevada failed to yield a better understanding of their ecological relationships, the Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep Recovery Program would fall far short of its objective of providing a basis from which future conservationists and wildlife managers can implement recovery strategies. The potential of disease transmission from domestic livestock to Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep has risen to the forefront of concerns, and Dr. Tom Stevenson will provide additional details on that subject in just a moment. We appreciate the support and interest of the California Fish and Game Commission, and we thank you for the opportunity to be here today to update you on a variety of aspects of the Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep Recovery Program. Our program provides regular monthly reports to the Commission and to the Department, as well as to cooperating agencies and other interested stakeholders. We also have instituted a series of annual reports, which are published in the department's magazine, Outdoor California. And the latest issue contains the 2006 annual report. It's just off the press, and I'm sure you'll be receiving copies in the immediate future. In the meantime, please do not hesitate to contact me or Dr. Stevenson or Pierce should you desire additional information. And at this time, I will turn the podium over to Dr. Stevenson, who will address a number of important issues that we believe the Commission will find of great interest.
Thank you, Dr. Blake. Do you have the remote? I thought I'd begin by touching on the goals, making sure everybody's aware of what the goals of the recovery plan are. The goal for recovery of the species is to try to achieve 305 adult ewes distributed among 14 herd units throughout the Sierra Nevada. The goal for the recovery program is to encourage recovery through science-based conservation and management. The goals for recovery are conservative and assume, in all likelihood, a higher population will exist, but we require these minimum numbers be identified for delisting. The recovery goals were derived in part from the historical evidence of the distribution of the species in the Sierra Nevada. There's substantial information, historical evidence of bighorn in the Sierra Nevada extending as far south as the Olancha area and all the way up to Sonora Pass. This slide also illustrates the herd units that we've identified. They're the black polygons. The only thing that's missing here is the Kern recovery unit to the west isn't illustrated in this figure. The direction of the program is determined in part by threats to recovery. Dr. Blake touched on a few of those: contact with domestic sheep and the potential for disease transmission, the effects of severe weather on the population, vulnerability of small populations to predation. In addition, one concern is pinion encroachment on winter range and the need for some habitat enhancement there, the potential for genetic drift in small populations. And then by status quo, one thing we need to be cautious about is a failure to pursue active management in adaptive context and it's going to require active management for recovery of this species. The broad recovery tasks include understanding current population trend, nutritional status and behavior, identifying limiting factors, and implementing measures to advance recovery goals and minimize threats to the species. Current and planned efforts more specifically include monitoring demography and population change, identifying habitat use and movements, quantifying habitat quality and carrying capacity, modeling habitat suitability. We've been working on that quite a bit in the last couple of years to direct our translocation efforts. Analyzing population viability. This is a big one that's come up recently in trying to get the recovery plan finalized. A number of stakeholders have called for that. Continuing genetic analyses. Implementing and assessing translocations. Implementing habitat enhancement. Analyzing disease risk. I'm going to talk quite a bit about that in a minute, and monitoring and managing predation. The current distribution of bighorn in the Sierras remains largely in the eastern Sierra and along the crest. We further refined our estimates of population numbers as well as distribution through extensive ground surveys as well as radio telemetry and GPS collars. We're continuing the genetic analyses to further understand the level of uniqueness of this taxon. Previous work has pretty clearly identified some morphological differences between Sierra Nevada sheep and desert sheep to the east. Actually, this slide depicts a Sierra Nevada sheep on the left, and these animals are actually roughly about the same age. They're mature rams. The animal on the left is Sierra Nevada. You notice the wider horn flare. The desert sheep tend to have the more massive horns, and the curl tends to stay closer to the head. Intensive ground surveys supplemented with helicopter surveys have indicated a strong upward trend in the population since the recovery effort began in 2000. Total population, including lambs born this year, is probably going to exceed 400 animals. And you'll notice that following translocations that occurred in the 80s and 90s, historically, or at least in recent history, most of the animals were concentrated in this Baxter sawmill herd. So we really had all of our eggs in one basket. Translocation efforts have now resulted in animals occupying roughly 5 geographic areas in the Sierra. So we've spread the animals out quite a bit more, and if this exponential trend continues, we're going to have quite a few animals available in the coming years for translocations, and that's going to be an essential part of the recovery effort. Numerically, the previous slide was total animals, rams, ewes, and lambs. This is just ewes. Recovery efforts are based on adult females, and numerically in total, we're halfway to recovery goals, but the other big portion of the recovery is expanding the geographic distribution, and that's going to be the challenge through translocations. And they'll only proceed at a pace that doesn't jeopardize the current herd units, but it's essential for meeting the overall recovery goals. Population numbers now, and this illustrates population numbers now and relative to where they were at listing. You can see the southern, central, and northern recovery unit numbers have all increased but continue to be below recovery goals, and this slide doesn't illustrate that there are additional herd units within those recovery units. The recovery units are the 4 shown there on the bottom of the graph. Other herd units still need to be occupied. And then we've got the Kern unit that's going to require a major translocation effort, which can't occur until we have sufficient animals available to really get a new recovery unit started. Deployment of GPS collars during captures has provided data on movements and habitat use that has refined herd unit boundaries, clarified risk of contact with domestic livestock, and made modeling habitat suitability possible. And this is Wheeler Ridge. It's our largest herd unit in the background there. This slide just depicts some winter and summer locations. Animals tend to summer at higher elevations, shown in pink and orange, and winter at lower elevations, illustrated in the blue. We're moving into the use of 3-dimensional GIS and the use of high-resolution remotely sensed imagery to evaluate habitat availability and carrying capacity for Sierra Nevada bighorn. Okay, last year when we presented to the commission, we were just beginning to try to really start quantifying the risk associated with grazing of primarily domestic sheep in the Eastern Sierra. We learned a tremendous amount over the past year relative to husbandry and land use of these domestic sheep, as well as bighorn movements. And the potential for contact can occur not only through straying of domestic sheep, but also through forays made typically by rams. Rams, particularly during the rut, wander out looking for females, and if they find domestic sheep, they're more than happy to move in with the domestic sheep, potentially contract a disease, and then potentially bring it back to the remainder of the bighorn population. And this has been demonstrated throughout the western U.S. as being a significant problem for bighorn sheep populations. We did some sampling of domestic sheep and determined that roughly 93% of domestic sheep carry Pasteurella, pneumonia-causing bacteria, and 25 of those tested positive for pathogenic strains of that bacteria, pathogenic to bighorn. Domestic sheep carry them routinely and don't exhibit any clinical symptoms. So looking at the disease risk, we've attempted to identify the level of risk through by looking at both bighorn and domestic sheep, and we're working to evaluate the potential for mitigation. Last summer we deployed GPS collars on domestic sheep. We continue to deploy GPS collars on a higher percentage of our bighorn rams in particular that are in proximity to domestic sheep. This slide illustrates a portion of the Northern Recovery Unit. Domestic sheep allotments are identified as the black polygons. The green dots are actually domestic sheep that were wearing GPS collars. The red dots are bighorn sheep locations from last summer. We've identified a number of ram movements that have created concern, and things got were raised to the forefront with the public a bit last year when we requested sought permission to take bighorn rams that, or I should say bighorn sheep that came into contact with domestic sheep in an effort to prevent any disease transmission. This is actually a ram that was observed by half the town of Bridgeport crossing the valley a couple of summers ago. And the recovery program has expended considerable effort in quantifying bighorn movements, primarily in the northern and central recovery unit because they're adjacent to the most to most of the domestic sheep grazing. With the aid of GPS collars in 2005, last summer, we detected some rapid long-distance movements by bighorn that actually traveled through domestic sheep allotments on the Humboldt-Toyabe National Forest. Fortunately, to the best of our knowledge, none of these animals came in contact with domestic sheep. And you can see this one ram identified in the yellow there actually traveled up through a couple of allotments. Fortunately, he did it a couple of weeks after the domestic sheep had come off the allotment. But he made that distance, traveled that distance of probably 10 miles up and back over a period of 3 days. Not surprisingly, given the proximity of allotments adjacent to alpine habitats that are preferred by bighorn, substantial risk of contact appears to remain. And this is just a three-dimensional image of an allotment identified in red and how it extends right up into alpine habitat that's preferred by bighorn. Data acquired to date is being used to quantify the risk and predict effects of potential disease outbreaks in this eastern Sierra through some modeling efforts. Quantifying the risk of contact in its simplest form has been conducted by overlapping a 100% kernel home range for the population over adjacent allotments. So we've overlaid this polygon of bighorn use areas over the domestic sheep allotments. However, this approach is somewhat conservative because it makes no attempt to predict future movements, especially by rams as the population expands. So that does give you some idea up there. The outer red polygon clearly overlaps allotments that are of great concern, but it doesn't do anything to identify the potential for movement into some of those adjacent allotments. Using a habitat suitability model that we produced over the last couple of years, we've been able to generate a friction surface, and then this is used to predict the likelihood of future movements. It's just another step in trying to quantitatively predict where bighorn might go, where the areas of greatest risk are. Our predictions relative to disease effects are going to be combining a population viability analysis with disease models. And we begin simply by predicting the probability in the population, and this is based on our demographic data, of individuals surviving from a lamb to a yearling to an adult. And then we bring in the disease model that incorporates the effects of susceptible and infected animals following introduction of a disease, and then we're actually able to model population change in the context of disease. The application of this model to an existing population allows us to simulate disease effects under a range of conditions. The model will be run under varying scenarios that manipulate the frequency and severity of disease events. And this modeling effort will help clarify the need for management alternatives and help us identify where the effort can best be expended to try to minimize that risk. This modeling effort and all of the quantitative data that's gone into it's hopefully going to allow us to ask what level of risk the public is willing to accept relative to domestic sheep grazing in the Eastern Sierra, and what are the ramifications of a disease outbreak if it occurs, and what are the effects on recovery. Domestic sheep monitoring last summer revealed the risks of grazing associated with grazing at high elevations, grazing in dense vegetation, and in some cases the lack of oversight by herders and dogs that was another potential mitigating factor that we just wanted to really try to quantify the data on. And this current work will allow us to ideally objectively look at the risk of disease and predict the consequences of an outbreak. So at this time I'm going to turn the podium back over to Dr. Blake.
Thank you, Tom. It has been hypothesized that an increase in the number of mountain lions in the eastern Sierra Nevada during the 1980s caused a behavioral response in mountain sheep to avoid low-elevation winter ranges. That scenario has been put forth as the explanation for the decline of bighorn sheep during that period because the reproduction presumably was limited due to a lack of nutrition. It is important to clarify, however, that the actual number of bighorn sheep killed by mountain lions was relatively small, and actual predation by mountain lions on bighorn has never been suggested as being the absolute cause of the decline. Mountain lions on one bighorn winter range in the eastern Sierra Nevada have been under study since 1991. The listing of the Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep as endangered has expanded this work to include all winter ranges of bighorn sheep in the region. In order to efficiently monitor the risk of mountain lion predation on bighorn sheep in the Sierra Nevada, it is absolutely necessary to have them radio collared. Mountain lions in this region have been documented to travel over 60 miles up and down the base of the eastern Sierra and to cross the crest to the west side many times. The use of tracks alone to determine the densities of mountain lion populations, to locate kills, to identify individual mountain lions, and to monitor their use of sheep winter ranges would be impossible in the steep rocky terrain of the Sierra Nevada in the absence of telemetry techniques. A protocol of simple eradication of mountain lions not only would be irresponsible, but would not be as feasible in the eastern Sierra as it might be in other locations. The steep, rugged terrain of the eastern Sierra makes the capture of lions extremely difficult and time-consuming. Individual cats must move into areas where they can be pursued safely with hounds, and in some cases it has taken literally months to catch specific animals known to use an area. Furthermore, most of the mountain lions that have been followed intensively in the eastern Sierra never prey on bighorn. Mountain lions that do not bother sheep still compete for resources with other mountain lions that might be sheep killers. Their removal would only open up space for an animal that could potentially become a problem. Additionally, females with kittens that feed exclusively on deer may pass that behavior on to their offspring, further decreasing the risk to future generations of bighorn sheep. For these reasons, the radio collaring of mountain lions provides the best solution to determining problem individuals that need to be targeted for removal, while allowing the remaining individuals to continue playing their important role in the ecosystem. At this time, we have 15 mountain lions fitted with radio collars. It's 9 females, 6 males, 2 of which are juveniles, and a number of younger animals as part of this program. Individuals that use bighorn sheep winter ranges have been the highest priority, but mountain lions in surrounding areas that may immigrate into bighorn range or have offspring that disperse into those areas have also been collared. This figure shows the movement patterns of 2 adult mountain lions that were responsible for predation on bighorn sheep. As you can see, a mountain lion that spends the majority of its time near Benton and the Nevada border can still be a confirmed threat to Sierra bighorn. In fact, we have taken several males that were confirmed to have killed bighorn that spent the majority of their time in the Glass Mountains east of Crowley Lake. Without radio collars, we probably would not have been able to identify those individuals, because in the areas where they kill sheep, it is impossible to pursue them. In many cases, locating the dead bighorn was entirely dependent on the mountain lion radio collars. Currently, we have located 15 bighorn killed by mountain lions since the program began, and 6 have been removed. An additional 3 lions known to have killed bighorn sheep died of causes unrelated to efforts to remove them. There were 2 road kills, and 1 was taken on a depredation permit. You can see here that the movement of mountain lions is significantly less during the winter when deer are concentrated on the winter ranges. The use of GPS technology has further enhanced the effectiveness of radio collars in meeting our objectives of protecting bighorn sheep and understanding the effect of mountain lions on their movements. Mountain lions that are known to use bighorn sheep winter ranges have GPS collars on them, and those collars are programmed to record a location 7 times per day during the winter months so that their movements can be precisely monitored. When mountain lions make an ungulate kill, they'll return to feed on it for several days, following the movement patterns displayed by the GPS collar onto a mapping, and using mapping software allows us to determine with a very high likelihood the location of mountain lion kills and to examine the movement of bighorn sheep in response to the presence of those lions. In addition to examining the behavioral interactions between bighorn sheep and mountain lions, we are planning to evaluate the behavioral responses of mountain lions to harassment as a means of lessening the probability of bighorn sheep being killed by lions. Mountain lions have been pursued and radio collared in the eastern Sierra Nevada since the early 1990s. We hope to look at movement patterns of animals after multiple pursuits and multiple captures to determine if harassment with hounds can permanently alter the home range of individual lions. Harassment has been attempted to move animals out of the sheep winter ranges thus far in the program, but its effectiveness is still unknown because of small sample sizes. The program recently received grant money for the purchase of additional radio collars to examine this question more closely. The threat of predation from other predators besides mountain lions also is the responsibility of the Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep Program. At this time, however, there have been no documented kills by bobcats or coyotes on Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep. One ewe was being fed upon by a bobcat, but investigation by personnel determined that the ewe had fallen in a rock slide and was severely injured and probably dead prior to being located by the cat. Survey for coyote sign around lambing areas turned up no evidence of threats by coyotes, and the high lamb recruitment and survival rates that we have witnessed support the assumption that these smaller predators are not having an effect, or at least a large effect or a noticeable effect, on the population growth rate of Sierra bighorn populations. Because weather and forage play important roles in bighorn sheep movements, our program has received additional funding to use satellite imagery to index greenup on traditional bighorn sheep winter ranges. Using these images, we hope to be able to determine the areas of greatest forage benefit for bighorn sheep and to evaluate the cost-benefit ratio for individuals that use different portions of the winter range for foraging. If bighorn sheep movement patterns can be predicted using this index, then these images and these data may be combined with other habitat models that Tom talked about and could be used in the future to select the best areas to reintroduce populations or to remove predators. The GPS technology I described is combined with a computer database that we have developed and that stores all of the information on the movements of mountain lions and bighorn sheep that are collected by field personnel and retrieved from telemetry collars. With this technology, we can go back and reference where tracks, kills, and individual animals have traveled. This helps with the identification of new sign, and in the future, we will use it to answer questions about population densities, habitat selection, and behavior for both mountain lions and bighorn sheep. And those data have enormous implications for understanding which lions are in fact preying on bighorn sheep. As noted in the introduction, the Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep Program has been of interest to many Californians and, for that matter, to many individuals across the nation. Conservation programs that emphasize large, charismatic vertebrates like bighorn sheep
are extremely popular, and they are also very visible. Further, large ungulates play important roles in ecosystems, and their conservation or extinction can have broad implications for ecosystem health and function. Dr. Becky Pierce, who oversees the predation ecology aspects of our program, could not be with us today, but Dr. Stevenson and I sincerely appreciate the opportunity that we have had to share with you some of our successes, our concerns, and our frustrations. I'd like to point out that much of the success of this program to date has been a result of the efforts of the two talented young scientists that work on the project. Tom and Becky are really paving new ground with the work that is being done here on behalf of Sierra Sheep. The talents and skills of Mr. Jeff Ostergaard should not go unrecognized. He's one of two predator detection specialists that I supervise through a contract with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Division of Wildlife Services. And Jeff's skills and talents have been extremely important to the recovery program. Not to mention his frustrations, which I'm sure you can see there, trying to deal with that hound. Similarly, Mr. Jeff Davis, the other predator detection specialist working on the project, has contributed his many talents to the success of this project. Jeff Davis and Jeff Ostergaard both have been working with staff from the Bishop Department of Fish and Game Office since 1991. They have contributed in many meaningful ways to both the Round Valley Deer Investigations and the Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep Recovery Program, and their skills and talents are sincerely appreciated. Others that are important contributors include Dr. John Wehausen, who has been involved with the Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep Program, with the Sierra Nevada Bighorn Sheep for more than 25 years, as well as a host of graduate students and seasonal employees. The students in particular are those that will make a tremendous difference in our understanding of these complex systems, and I expect them all to make meaningful contributions to conservation science as they mature and progress through their careers. And thank you all for the opportunity to be here today. If there are any questions, we'd be pleased to entertain them now or at a more convenient time, perhaps in a less formal setting. Thank you.
Commissioner Gustafson?
I had a really important question. Who's your
Who's
your photographer? Those are stunning images. I mean, really stunning.
No professional photographers. it's just hundreds of pictures and good luck.
Phenomenal.
And lots of opportunities.
Really phenomenal.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Good work, Vern. It's good to see you. Last time I saw you, were laying down in a hospital bed, yeah. So it's good to see you're up and continuing on your good work.
Thank you, Mr. Flores.
Okay, Mr. Carlson.
Okay, we'll move back to item number 6, discussion and possible adoption of amendments to Section 632B72, Title 14. Regarding commercial lobster fishing in Dana Point State Marine Park. Turn that over to Sankey.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. John Ugritz with the department will give a very quick overview of where we've come on this issue, just so you have that context.
Thank you, Mr. President. Commissioners, John Ugritz with the Department's Marine Region. We wanted to briefly review some of the information about the Dana Point State Marine Park and the proposal for allowing commercial lobster trapping in the area. To review, the status quo in this area was originally 10 marine protected areas along the Orange County coast established between 1968 and 1982. 7 were originally marine life refuges, and none of the 7 officially allowed commercial take within their boundaries. The department, through a handshake agreement, originally allowed certain fishermen to continue take, of lobster, and this was later interpreted to mean that all lobster take could continue in the seven areas. Subsequently, this was misrepresented as a regulation in a variety of documents that came from outside the department, and the general perception was that commercial lobster take was allowed in these areas. Through two regulatory processes, the areas along the Orange County coast were changed both in their designation, and some of them changed to officially allow lobster take. The Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act required the renaming of all existing marine protected areas in California, and that occurred with no change to the legal language. This was implemented in April of 2005, and the seven original marine life refuges along the Orange County coast all became state marine parks with no commercial take. Returning to the status quo in these areas would mean no commercial take in all seven areas. The department requested allowing commercial take in six of the seven areas shortly after that, and this was implemented in November of 2005. The Dana Point State Marine Park was not included in that regulatory action. To review the area itself, you're seeing here block 757, which is a commercial fish landings block for reporting purposes. The Dana Point State Marine Park, oops, looks like this isn't working, is shown in pink right around the Dana Point itself. And I would point out that lobster trapping, while it occurs in this entire block, does not occur equally in all areas of the block. The area shown in pink highlighted here is the area shallower than 30 feet, and the area in blue is the area shallower than 60 feet, in between 30 and 60 feet. As you see, the park lies entirely within the 30-foot depth contour, and 99% of all lobster take in this block occurs shallower than 60 feet of depth. So you can see that while it's a large block, the fishing is concentrated in the nearshore area, and some of that area is included in the park itself. About 48% of the Block 757 catch could have come from the Dana Point State Marine Park if you assume that all unspecified catch in all logbook data came from that area. And that is a large assumption, because clearly we know that some of the unspecified catch came from other areas in Block 757. That would represent about 16% of the Orange County catch and 2% of the California lobster catch for the whole state. We did a landing data analysis in the initial statement of reasons. We've also gone back and reviewed that based on some comments we received. We know that 25 fishermen caught lobster in Block 757, though it's clear that not all of these fished in the Dana Point State Marine Park. The potential range of impacts is between 25% and 100% of the Block 757 catch. Again, 100% of the catch would mean that every single lobster caught in that entire block came from the very small area of the park itself. Using that range, the maximum potential loss in ex-vessel value would be between $60,000 and $245,000 annually to the fishermen fishing in that block, and this represents between about 2% and 5% of the statewide lobster catch. So to sum up, the decision is certainly in the hands of the commission. We know that you have requested and received input from the legislature as required by the act, giving you authority to make changes to existing state marine protected areas, and the department's happy to answer any questions you have.
No questions? All right, we have John Guth, followed by John Duffy, Roger Healy. Yeah, you got to work on your E. Steve Benvenides, Greg Helms, Kate Wing, and Paul Weakland. You used your allotted time up earlier today. No, I'm just kidding. We'll make sure you get covered. You'll be the last one up.
President Flores, members of the commission and staff. I'm John Guth, the president of the California Lobster and Fishermen's Association. I appreciate John's presentation. It's fairly accurate, I believe, and represents what takes place there in the lobster fishing. Although we, as fishermen, did a straw poll of logbooks from the guys that work in there, and we came up with a higher percentage of fish caught in that in the closed area. Basically, we need to fish in 30 feet of water there because the boat traffic going around the buoy out there will chop us up pretty good if we don't. So we're most of the gear is in that closed area that we have historically fished for since probably 100 years it's been fished. So we've been in there, we fished there, and through some kind of a regulation glitch or whatever you want to call it, we're out of there. As of the middle of last season, we were notified that this interpretation took us out of that area. So that's where we are. That's why we came before you to try and get that area back. We came before your Marine Resource Committee and then also in Mammoth to present our case. And we do have 29 boats in Dana Point, and I really don't know. I mean, we know everyone. I fish there myself. But I don't really know of a boat that does not fish in that area because it's close. It's very productive. And if you look at the numbers, that 757 block number catches maybe 2 to 3 times more on an average than all the other 60 block numbers in the state that lobsters are delivered in. So even if we catch 48% or whatever you want to say there, it's a significant amount. So it's important to us. We have a lot of boats working there. Historically, we've fished there, and we'd certainly like to get it back. We have a clean fishery. The resource is healthy there. I fished 43 years, and it's one of the most productive places that I've seen year to year to year. It's lobsters are good size there, and we catch well there. And as I say, we don't catch, it's a clean, the traps are very clean there. We don't impact the sport fleet in any way. They fish out, they anchor outside of us when they fish in that area, the charter boats and most of the sport boats. So we'd appreciate being able to get it back. Thank you. And I appreciate the commission's action on this and the time that they've worked it in for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Duffy, followed by Roger Healy, followed by Steve Benavides.
Good afternoon, President Flores, members of the commission and department and commission staff. I am John Duffy, and I'm speaking today in support of the proposed amendments to Section 632 to redesignate the Dana Point State Marine Park to the Dana Point State Marine Conservation Area, thereby reauthorizing the longstanding commercial harvest of spiny lobster. I do this based on some 50 years of direct personal experience with California spiny lobster as a recreational diver, as a department marine biologist with extensive involvement in research management and fishery policy development of the spiny lobster fishery, and yes, even as a one-time commercial lobster fisherman in a 1965-66 season right here in Santa Barbara. The three specific reasons I support the proposed changes are: one, commercial lobster fishing has been lawfully conducted in this area since before the establishment of the reserve in 1969, and then continually until November of last year, with no documented negative impact to either the lobster resource or the habitat within the reserve. Two, at the Marine Resources Committee meeting to consider this matter, the department provided an assessment of likely negative impacts to the fishermen who will be displaced if you choose not to adopt, and the likely contribution of this area to the lobster harvest in Block 757. While the department was unable to be precise, and you heard that again today, it is clear that their findings illustrate that the age-old principle, well known in the real estate world, location, 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 when translated to habitat, 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 applies equally to the lobster fishery. Simply put, if the area remains closed, the fishermen will have lost access to this prime habitat, which cannot be replaced. And thirdly, when I asked directly at the Marine Resources Committee meeting if both the department and the commissioners present, after considering the biological, sociological, and policy sides of this matter, were in support of the proposal, the answer was yes. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Executive Director, President, and fellow commissioners. My name is Roger Healy. I represent the Dana Cove Commercial Fishermen's Association. I'm the president, believe it or not. I represent virtually all the 30 fishermen out of Dana Point Harbor. I think one or two of the lobster fishermen aren't members. I've myself personally been fishing there 17 years. I appreciate the commission as well as the department's actions in trying to get this area back to letting us lobster fish in there again. I do have a little bit of bone to pick about the area itself. The outside area of the Dana Point State Marine Park lies in about 40 feet of water. I think that's a pretty conservative estimate. I fish at the latter part of the year. I talked to the wardens, and we established where the outside of the reserve or park would be, and it's in about 40-foot depth contour. Since that incorporates highest percentage of the greatest part of the fishable reef, pushes our percentages a lot higher. If you break down the area of 757, it represents 50% of the total catch for the Orange County area, which is much of what the Dana Point fleet fishes. And I think that you could look, it's a pretty short summary of what I gave here. I just appreciate the commission's time as well as the department's, and I'd appreciate if we get this area back to be able to fish by this fall. Thank you.
President Flores, commissioners, staff, my name is Steve Benavides. I was asked to come today on behalf of the Greater Los Angeles Area Council of Divers. And before you, you have a packet with about 30 letters in it that come from a combination of conservation groups, businesses, and the dive community. And we are here to oppose the redesignation of the State Marine Park at this time. We have two major reasons for doing this. It's rather straightforward. First, this area was granted special protection a long time ago, because it obviously demonstrated something that was very important and worth protecting. And now, with the decline of the ocean resources, the use of that or the protection offered by that park may have a very serious and far-reaching effect. I know for a fact, the second reason, we are about to go through a rather exhausting remapping of all the Southern California resource in just a couple of months. And so this whole process that evaluates the utility of a reserve versus having it be open is about to be plowed very, very thoroughly. I was on the siting committee for the MLPA in Southern California, and I can say there were several proposals that were asking for the State Marine Park area of Dana Point to be made a marine refuge with no take at all, and that was in recognition of the fact that this is potentially very important habitat. It could fit into the MLPA network, and we think that opening up the designation now would be premature, because we have to go through this whole process again very shortly, and I think a better job will be done by exposing the pluses and minuses of whether your action should be taken to a much broader public outreach and scientific investigation that will go through the MLPA process that the department is taking. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Greg Helm, followed by Kate Wing, followed by Paul Weakland, and then Chris Heflinger.
Good afternoon, members of the commission, Mr. President, and members of staff. I'm Greg Helms. Welcome to Santa Barbara. We love to have you here. I'm with the Ocean Conservancy. I run the Santa Barbara and Channel Islands region operation. Here's our perspective on this. We're clearly in the state moving in a transition towards a unified and standardized way of naming and enacting, approving, reviewing MPAs as we implement the MAIA and the MLPA. And as we move these decisions in this forum to the Fish and Game Commission, where it belongs, now the legislature, we're sort of in the, I guess, growing pains of that process. Part of that process should be to move away from piecemeal, ad hoc decisions, things like gentlemen's agreements, because they're confusing and they're difficult, if not impossible, to enforce. It's irregular and just not a workable situation. I'm certain that there's 100% agreement that we all want, the unification and less of the confusion. Our ideal is that no change be done here by the Fish and Game Commission pending treatment by the MLPA. And I think you have the flexibility to do that because, as your preparation documents that staff prepared showed, that six of the seven areas, as we try to move from refuge to park, conservation area, or reserve under the MMAIA, were left open. So I think you have the flexibility to do that, and we would strongly recommend that you do. Failing that, please at least leave the area, you know, open for the kind of exhaustive review we want in the Marine Life Protection Act, because you know that's the orderly process that we're moving to, and then we need, I think, to protect to keep orderliness and coherence in the regulatory process. I understand this is a relic of some change we're having, and I don't have a real resource argument to make, but I would argue for that orderly process. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, members of the Commission, staff. Kate Wing with the Natural Resources Defense Council. You've heard a number of speakers already speak briefly to the issue of looking at these protected areas, these parks, conservation areas, whatever they are to be, in a larger context. And that's primarily our concern with this particular action by the Commission at this time. If and when the MLPA process decides where it's moving next, if that's the south, then we're looking at the possibility of revisiting these areas or at least doing a much broader context look at them again when we go through that process. And this seems to be just sort of, unfortunately, bad timing and a bit of a regulatory artifact of the Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act because of the way the nomenclature was changed, and now the Commission is looking before it with resolving this issue of should these historic legislatively created areas now be changed to one type of marine protected area or another, and then possibly looking at that again in the larger context of the MLPA in the future. So it's really primarily a process concern. I would agree with both the department and other folks who have spoken. There's not particularly a concern with the conservation of the lobster fishery at this point in time. It's really much more an issue of sort of trying to take a comprehensive look at where closures are and aren't in Southern California. And I would actually propose perhaps a slightly different tack on that. All this year, the commission and staff and the department have been working very hard at creating a new way to come up with the commission's priorities. What are you going to work on next, and why, and how are you going to make those decisions? As we know, there are a lot of fishery management plans that are still sort of sitting in limbo, trying to get themselves into a fully formed and implemented position. And back in the old days, lobster, along with, you know, halibut and some of these other fisheries you're hearing about little bits and pieces of, was one of those prioritized fisheries. So certainly looking at what should we be doing for the lobster fishery, for lobster populations and for fishermen as a whole, that to me is the type of context that I would like to see this type of decision looked at in, rather than sort of a piecemeal situation like you have before you today. Thanks.
Thank you. Paul Weeklin, followed by Chris Heflinger.
Commissioners, Paul Weeklin. This area in Dana Point was supposed to be the premier test, the experiment for the marine no fishing zone, and that the different types of harvest criteria and habitat in this small little area was supposed to be able to demonstrate the validity of the concept. But we see here today that some of these flawed concepts need to be looked at again and again, not pass over them so you can look at them further later. They should be looked at now, they should be looked at later, they should be looked at and looked at and looked at. And the idea of not looking at these problems is idiotic, in my opinion. And that the inequities of having a no-fishing zone, and you're going to allow fishing? What about the urchin in this area? It also is healthy, the habitat and populations of the urchin harvesting in this area have not diminished. Now, why is it only going to be lobsters? The urchin as well has a healthy reputation and should also be allowed. And a no-fishing zone, it just shows how convoluted and mistaken we are in this area.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Chris Heflinger. I'm a trap fisherman. I actually don't fish in the reserve or the whatever it's called, but I am impacted by the fact that these individuals that do fish there now have to get that $35,000 catch somewhere else where I fish. And That's something that hasn't been considered very much in a lot of our planning process here. And I hope we develop some techniques to look at that a little more thoroughly when MLPA comes to the southern region. Now, as far as the argument I've been hearing that we shouldn't examine this now because we could do it when MLPA comes down, well, the question I would ask is, why is it this one reserve? The department can answer it. Why is it this one spot doesn't allow lobster fishing, but the other ones did? You know, there's an inconsistency there. Why don't we go with consistency? So that's one thing. And then I kind of took another approach to analyzing this area that maybe some of you folks might be interested in. I got a handout here. I was told you have it. And what I did on the back page of the handout is I took what is our block numbers for Southern California, and I went and I shaded in kind of in a, you know, this is a GIS format. I shaded in all the area that's lobster habitat. On the coast, you have 31 blocks. At the island, you have 30 blocks. So then we know we have about 61 blocks where we're fishing lobster, okay? And a way to analyze this to see how important this block number is, maybe not this little area in the block number, but the block number itself, is to divide 61 into the total take in the lobster fishery, which is in the years 2000 through 2003 averaged 695,000 pounds. And what you come up with is an average of 11,000 pounds per block. This block harvested 35,000 pounds. That's over three times as much as the average block. This is an important block. You know, when you take it away, you're going to push everybody else into blocks that aren't as resilient to harvest. And you know what's going to happen to lobster stock. And the other thing is you got a 100-year history here, and you still, I mean, these guys have been fishing for 100 years, and you still are getting 35,000, three times as much out of the average block out of this area that's been fished for 100 years. So you have to ask yourself, conservation-wise, are they even having an impact on the stock? And those are the things that I would consider. So thank you.
Department?
Is that the last comment?
Yes.
There's a couple things we wanted to follow up with. The reason the department did not include Dana Point in the earlier change was that it is found, or was originally found, I should say, in a separate section of Fish and Game Code. It was established, and separate code sections were created for Dana Point with separate reasons and more detail. And as we explained in our eyesore, that's why it was separate and why we're considering it separately now. That said, the commission did indicate to the department that they were interested in considering this issue this year. And we do understand, especially given the timeline, that it's important to come up with a recommendation now so that this decision can be made before the lobster season begins and before potential impacts could occur for this year. That said, I think it is important to understand that if and when MLPA comes to Southern California, the commission should be very clear that all areas will be reconsidered. And just because a special consideration was given to this area now, that doesn't mean it won't be reconsidered, as other areas in Southern California that were recently designated would be reconsidered. So I think it's definitely up to your discretion at this point. The rationale for keeping it a park is the original designation. We don't feel there's a direct biological immediate concern right now. Again, that's not what Marine Life Protection Act will consider. It'll consider habitats and ecosystems across the board.
Okay. Commissioners, any questions? Any recommendations to go forward?
Richard, did you want to report on the Marine Resources Committee? I mean, we heard this while I was still serving on the committee.
Well, I was not present, unfortunately, at the Monterey. Excuse me, at the Mammoth meeting. So, I didn't do it.
I thought it was heard here in Santa Barbara. Maybe I'm mistaken.
No, we did have a presentation here in Santa Barbara. Okay. I think one of the things from my perspective is that this is not taking a park and changing a designation. It is, but that's just verbiage. What this is a fishery that's been going on in one location for a very long period of time that appears to be a very robust, from a biological perspective, fishery that because of a glitch or some other reasons was allowed to continue given the park designation. And I find it inappropriate at this point in time, personally, from this commissioner's perspective, to remove lobster fishing from that area when lobster fishing clearly is not damaging the area. The fishery is robust. It has continuously gone on. We wouldn't fundamentally be changing a darn thing given what has happened throughout history. Yes, we will be revisiting the entire Southern California region as from a perspective of MLPAs, and it might very well be that this will be end up being designated a state reserve. I mean, who knows? I'm not suggesting that I would think that, but it might be. It is the case that there is some misconception that Southern California is going to be next. Southern California may not be next. That may come a little bit further on down the line. So I don't see any reason why we should take from an existing robust lobster fishery where there is no biological reason and no process reason either, because MLPA is a totally separate process and has its own inertia. So personally, I would be all for allowing fundamentally the previous status quo.
I'd like to agree with you, Richard. While I was serving on the Marine Resources Committee, we heard this item, and again, we heard it as an oversight that this area was not included to continue, and in fact, until last season was continuing. All the letters that we received in opposition to this change back to the existing practice appeared to be misinformed. In fact, most of them thought there hadn't been fishing here for 30 years, lobster, and in fact, there has been. So I thought that was enlightening and to the arguments about that. I too agree that during the MLPA process, we will be revisiting this, and it could very well be that this would be closed at that point in time. And as long as everybody's aware of that situation and there doesn't appear to be a resource issue at this time, I think we'd be willy-nilly on the reverse. This should have been changed from the testimony we've received. It should have been changed previously. It was an oversight. And I'd like to get this cleaned up at this point and then look at all these areas consistently as we move forward.
I agree, Commissioner Gustafson. In fact, you mentioned a lot of letters we received seem to be fraught with misconceptions. Even the dean of Cal State Fullerton's marine science was completely off base, didn't understand what was going on. That's a pretty deep misconception.
With that said, I'm going to have Mr. Carlson read a recommended motion.
Suggested motion that the Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the authority vested in 2860 of the Fish and Game Code, hereby amends Section 632, Subsection B, Title 14, relating to commercial lobster fishing at Dana Point to allow the lobster fishing to take place. And then note that the regulatory language will be included as an appendix in the Commission Official Office Master Minutes.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Before you vote.
Yes.
I think we need to make sure the motion indicates that the designation will change from State Marine Park to State Marine Conservation Area.
Yeah, and that would be that would be in the office
okay.
or the
we just
the,
wanted on
Commission
record.
Master Minutes. Yeah. Thank
you. Included in my motion.
Wonderful.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 No opposed? Motion carries. Okay. All right, we're going to break for lunch for 30 minutes. It's what, 1:45? Or 12? Yeah, 1:45. And we're going to break into executive session. So I need to clear the room. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to reconvene the Fish and Game Commission meeting, and Executive Director will move us on to the next item, item 7, I guess.
Yep. Thank you. We will go to item 7, receipt of Department Legislative Report and possible consideration of Commission positions on proposed legislation. I don't believe the department has a report, but we do have some information from commission staff. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct.
And we have a speaker who's going to speak about a bill, SB 1535, that involved the commission. Kate Wing, go ahead, Kate.
Thank you very much. Kate Wing with NRDC. Just to speak briefly to SB 1535, I've brought it to your attention at a few of the other meetings so far this year, and the commission staff have been very helpful in talking it over with me and reviewing it as it's made its way through the lovely California legislature. And in fact, it has emerged. It passed the assembly yesterday, and it's just going to go back to the Senate for concurrence. And so we expect it to show up on the governor's desk. It no longer has the commercial landings fees in it that it originally had to try and increase revenues to the department and adjust those fees for inflation, but it does still include the language that would allow CEQA fees to be indexed for inflation. The bill is unopposed right now. We've been able to work that out with the developers and the board and the foresters and a variety of other industry groups, so the bill has no opposition. And it also still includes the language about the commission being allowed to hire staff. So now it is in the law that you will legally be allowed to have more than just an executive director, as well as the language pertaining to the commission's meeting structure, which we hope, and we have reviewed this with a number of legal folks, and our intention is not to negatively impact the commission's meeting structure at all, but simply, and as I've talked about extensively with the waterfowl folks who were here earlier, California Waterfowl Association has also supported this bill. A number of other folks in this room have supported this bill, particularly for some of these provisions. It would just give the commission more flexibility in where and when it sets its meetings. It would make it so that you are no longer required to have your meetings in certain cities at certain times, and particularly for something like, say, the waterfowl regulations, where you have to respond to a federal set of regulations. We're hoping it would give you more flexibility in being able to set meetings that really let you do what you need to do at the time you need to do it. And that's what's in it that pertains to the commission. I can provide updated copies of it, I believe, in its latest version. If not today, hopefully tomorrow. Ledge Council's a little behind. But I hope that you will all find it to be a useful bill, and that if the commission doesn't want to take a position on it, I'm not certainly encouraging you to do that one way or the other, that you'll certainly let folks know you think it's a fine bill.
We have one public comment on this item, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. I have one comment. The Fish and Game Commission, in its strategic planning, saw fit to put the public forum number one. And before then, they had always hidden the public forum way back, number 9, 10, 11. Oh, we'll move it to the end of the day.
Paul, we're talking about legislation right now. You got something to say on legislation, help yourself. But if you're going to on another subject, this is not the time to do it.
I was trying to lead into the meeting location. In the past, it was seen fit to hold all the meetings in Sacramento.
This is not legislation, Paul. I'm telling you, sit down if you're not talking about legislation. That's the item we're on right now. So if you don't have something to say about the legislation, take your seat, please.
And so that the meeting location has mushroomed into a large expense. Upon the meeting location also are the facilities that are needed.
Did you hear what I just said?
I'm still using.
You're not talking about legislation.
I'm talking about the financial burdens that are being put upon
us. Take your seat, or I'll have someone help you take your seat.
Well, thank you very much for letting me express myself. Not.
Anything else on legislation? Any commission comment?
Item 8, receipt of department informational items.
Deputy Director Mastrip had to catch a flight, and he informed me that the department did not have an update on its budget, that it was still, they are still implementing the increase in positions that they received, and they are working on hiring those, filling those positions, which he had talked about at the last meeting. Beyond that, there was no update. Item 8B, update on Lake Davis project. Dr. Ed Pert is here to give the commission an update on that.
All right. Good afternoon, commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to give an update on what's happening at Lake Davis. Mr. Carlson informs me that brevity is beautiful at this point in the day, so I'll try to be as brief as I can. And I also am going to try to skip much of the information that I presented to you in May in Tahoe City to get to the things that you need to know that are going on with the project right now, because there are a number of things happening right now. First of which is that the draft environmental document, which is a CEQA NEPA document, because we're working closely with the Forest Service on this, is going to be available to the public on September 1st. There'll be a 45-day review and comment period on that document, and so I think you need to be aware of that. And I'm just going to review the need for the project right now very briefly and then talk about what the commission's potential role in the Lake Davis project will be. So let's see if I can get the... Thank you. So I'm going to talk about the pike, why pike are a problem in California, really briefly what we're proposing to do about it, and then what the commission's possible role in the pike eradication project would be. As I think all of you are aware, non-native invasive species are a serious problem in California. I won't go into detail about that, but the northern pike is considered a non-native invasive species in California. Some of the characteristics that make it a good invasive species or a successful invasive species is that it's a very efficient top predator, and it creates serious changes in systems where it becomes established. They lay a lot of eggs, and so they have the opportunity and the potential to increase their numbers rapidly. And if you look at their environmental requirements or tolerances, they're very broad, especially for a cold water fish species. So, for example, they're considered a cold water fish, but they tolerate a wide range of temperatures. They can survive in waters up to 80 degrees and in higher Fahrenheit. They also tolerate very low oxygen conditions, conditions that are similar to those that catfish and carp can tolerate, which, again, is very, very unusual for a cold water species. And they can also live in water that's about half the salinity of seawater. So those brackish areas are actually available for pike to establish themselves. And for these reasons, the department's very, very concerned about the spread of northern pike in California. And if you look at those tolerances and what pike can survive in and some instances where they have been introduced in habitats where it's suitable, you can have a problem that occurred and that it continues to occur in Lake Davis, where they have had serious negative effects on the fishery there, and that's translated into economic problems and even social issues for the community that's having now to deal with pike in Lake Davis. And what the department's concerned about is that because there are many places in California that are suitable for pike in terms of habitat requirements, we now have pike contained up there in Lake Davis, as I have on the map, and if they escape from there, they can spread to other waters, and we're extremely concerned about them spreading to the Sacramento-San Joaquin system and the Delta in particular. And just to quickly review what we're doing now, we are moving forward with trying to implement or implementing various recommendations to control and contain pike in Lake Davis. We've been doing that since 2000. We've tried all sorts of things, some very successfully, like electrofishing and seining, and we've even tried detonation cord, which wasn't very successful. We've put a lot of effort into containing pike, and we've, in fact, removed over 60,000 pike from Lake Davis up till now. Unfortunately, the numbers of pike continue to grow, and so we just cannot get a handle on the pike population despite these efforts. And the real problem there is that as the pike population grows, there's a number of ways that pike can escape. They can escape over the spillway of the dam in a high water year, and in fact, we came very close to that this year. And in addition to that, the pike have basically spread throughout the lake at this point in time, and our recent surveys this year show that there are pike in the cove right next to the spillway. So if it does spill, pike are going to go downstream, and the cat's out of the bag at that point. They could also escape through the outlet dam, although there's a fish screen there, and that helps. But the big wild card here is human movement, and in fact, the more fish you have in the lake, the easier they are to catch. the easier it is to move fish around. And we had an enforcement checkpoint station a few months back, and out of about 100 cars that were stopped, there were two people that had live pike that were actually moving live pike out of Lake Davis. Now, we don't believe that that was malicious. It was ignorance. We've stepped up enforcement. We've stepped up signage, education. We've had a subsequent checkpoint a couple weeks ago, and it was 100% compliance. But it does highlight the potential ease with which people can catch pike and move pike out of Lake Davis at this time. And so what if pike escape? And I'll go through these briefly. I don't want to belittle the importance of these things. Pike could have devastating effects on sport fisheries, on commercial fisheries, on non-game species that are already imperiled, could become further imperiled, and ultimately our ability to pump water from the delta around the state of California, which would have obvious economic impacts. So what's the department proposing to do about this? And this is all detailed in the environmental document that'll be out on September 1st, available to the public. We're proposing to draw the reservoir down to about 15,000 acre feet. That's about a quarter of the normal summer water level. We will eradicate pike with a formulation of liquid rotenone. We will neutralize the rotenone somehow. There's a number of ways that we may do that that are being evaluated. There'll be lots of monitoring and reporting. Various mitigation measures will be required, and then we will ultimately restock the reservoir and tributaries to hopefully create the type of fishery or reproduce the type of fishery that it was prior to the existence of pike. There's also seven alternatives that are included in the draft document. Five of those involve the use of rotenone and just dropping the lake to different lake levels. There's another non-chemical option, which would involve dewatering the reservoir and the tributaries, and then there's a no-project alternative. And so if rotenone's employed, and this is where the commission may be asked to take action as requested by the department, the flows in the dam will be cut off for up to 5 days to allow thorough mixing of the rotenone in the lake. And then there'll be a neutralization required, and we have four neutralization options. One of those includes shutting off the flows from the dam for up to 45 days. So if a project to eradicate pike moves forward, it's likely that flows in Big Grizzly Creek that flows out of Lake Davis would be greatly reduced, and the amount of reduction would depend on which alternative was chosen. So if that were to occur, Fish and Game would likely come to the commission and request that you all adopt a regulation under Fish and Game Code 219A to suspend Fish and Game Code 5937 as a cautionary measure to protect fish and wildlife. And if you're not intimately familiar with Fish and Game Code 5937, it basically states, and this is paraphrased, that the owner of any dam must allow sufficient water at all times to pass through the dam or around the dam or over the dam to keep fish below the dam in good condition. So we're going to have to stop the flows from the dam. Keep in mind that there's a natural accretion that starts about 200 feet below the dam. So there's water that's going to be accumulating in Big Grizzly Creek. So the flows won't be completely cut off and the stream won't be completely dry, but the flows will be greatly reduced if we go forward with this. And so the need for the use of the 219A is that the timing is critical for a project like this. There'll probably be a need to draw the reservoir down, and then when the conditions are right, which would be in the fall, and in this case it's proposed to be the fall of 2007, there's a narrow window with which you can apply the rotenone to the reservoir. And so if that happens, we really want to minimize the risk of delay from legal challenges based on 5937. So if you could suspend 5937 for a very limited time, we would be able to avoid that legal risk. And I want to be clear that the department does not believe that we will be in violation of 5937. This is just a cautionary measure so that in case it's an extremely dry year or something like that, then we would not be in violation of that. And in addition, if you think about one of the components of this is at some point in time, if we don't cut the flows off, there'll be toxic water traveling downstream, so those fish would not be in good condition anyway, but we're trying to make sure that we meet the letter of the law here. And lastly, I just want to say that if we come forward and request the commission to take this action, we'll use Section 219A in a very short-term way, and it would be specific and limited to just the purpose of this particular project, and we would not be asking for any sort of blanket suspension of 5937. So that's all I have. Hopefully I've been brief enough, and I'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Any questions or comments from the commissioners on Davis Lake?
The publication of the circulation of the EIR-EIS, or the CEQA NEPA document, will begin on September 1st. When will the public hearings?
Oh, I should have. We have a public hearing. There'll be public hearings. Boy, I'm sorry, I don't have that information at my fingertips.
Okay, you can email it.
There's going to be There's going to be four public hearings. There'll be one in Portola. There's going to be one at the end of September. I believe it's the 26th of September, and then I think the other one is October 1st in Sacramento. There'll be two per day, one in the afternoon and one in the evening, both in Portola and in Sacramento.
If you could let us know when those are, I'd
appreciate
that.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that, and I could call right now and give you the information.
Well, you'll be doing a press release on that also, right?
Yeah, there's going to be a press release.
We'll forward that.
The draft document will be available on our website. Okay. It'll be available at various libraries and some fish and game offices in various places. So if you'd like to get a CD copy of that, that would be easy to do.
Okay.
We're printing
a
limited number of them because they're large, and I'd be happy to get you whatever you need.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very
much. Thank you.
Okay, I have no public speaker cards on that one. On item 8C, avian influenza, the department, Sankey, indicated that they had no update on that at this point, but they are continuing monitoring and continuing working with federal and state partners on that issue. So that brings us to item 8D, which is update on the implementation of the halibut trawl bill, and Gary Stacey, regional manager of the Marine Region, will update us on that.
Thank you, commissioners, Mr. Carlson. I'd like to briefly report on what the department is doing for implementing the trawl bill and frame that in the context of the recent reorganization our Marine Region has done that Sankey has presented to you, and we intend to go into more detail at subsequent meetings. But basically, we are using the new resources that we've gotten in this year's budget, 46 PYs and about $9 million, in a way that will allow us to begin collecting the much-needed baseline information for the variety of fisheries that we manage in California. And with respect to the halibut trawl bill, our intention is to focus initially on generating baseline information about halibut numbers. If we go forward with a fishery management plan in the future, having good numbers about the population is going to be really critical to do that. We're organizing a separate project with about 10 people that will focus on state-managed fish species and halibut and the other species in the trawl bill, some of the species of shrimp and prawns that are also covered in that trawl bill will be folded into that as well. We're developing, finishing the paperwork, starting interviews. We'll be hiring these new people over the next few months. And they're going to hit the ground running from the standpoint of starting to collect baseline information. That's it.
Any comments or questions from commissioners?
And we have one public speaker on this issue, Tom Raftikin.
Members of the commission, my name is Tom Raftikin, president of the United Anglers of Southern California. What we're trying to do is really emphasize the importance of this trawl law, not trawl bill. We're all so familiar with the Marine Life Protection Act and the what's happening on the ocean out there right now. And you've got efforts to close fishing in very large areas, when in fact, if you really take a look closely at this, the reason that these efforts are being made are because of destructive gear. And if you manage the destructive gear, you don't get in the situation where you have to take such drastic measures. Mr. Stacey talked about, you know, baseline information and about halibut, shrimp, and prawns, and that's interesting, but the law actually says go out and get the permits in place. And I know emergency permits were brought out forward this year, but if you're going to update us on the bill, update us on how many permits are out there, what the status is, and where they're going. This is very important legislation. This is the last missing piece in management as far as trawling the worst, most destructive gear type out there, dragging nets along the bottom of the ocean. But this stuff's real important, and we're going to follow it very closely down the line, and we want to see how it's going, and you know, we'd appreciate that update and look for the department to do that. Thank you.
I agree, Tom. I mean, to me, it is the most destructive gear, and we have to be extraordinarily careful with it.
All right.
I'd like to be kept informed by any concerns you guys have got.
Okay. Moving to item 8E, other. The department would like to give an update on the San Miguel Island abalone survey. John Ugritz has a brief update on that.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. John Ugritz. We just wanted to be sure you're aware that we are moving forward with your direction to consider an abalone fishery at San Miguel Island. And the first and perhaps most important step of this is a very comprehensive survey of the abalone abundance that will occur next week. And the department has worked very closely with the commercial fishermen and some recreational volunteer groups to make this survey happen. There will be more than 40 staff present, both from the department, the commercial fishermen, and other volunteer groups, including recreational anglers. We are really looking forward to it. It's going to be a chance to get out there together and see what's on the bottom. And it's been a lot of work. We've had tremendous support from all of the groups involved, and we're really looking forward to see the results. You all are invited to come out if you'd like. We will be having a media day on Tuesday, if any of you would like to join us on that day, please do let me know, and I'll make the arrangements. It should be quite impressive, and it's just going to move a big step forward in all of us agreeing to what's out there and moving forward with considering the fishery.
Any questions or comments to John?
Thanks.
Thank you, John.
There's one speaker.
Okay, Dan?
Chris Voss, speak on this item.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Chris Voss, and I'm representing the California Abalone Association. And I would just like to thank the Commission for supporting this process and the Department for working really closely in a really constructive collaborative effort that has, to this point, been really a worthwhile working relationship that we've developed with specific department members. There are 55 participants in the survey process next week. There'll be 10 boats. There's 8 agencies. The 20 commercial abalone divers that are going to participate have all gone through extensive training in using the protocols, which was really valuable because it's pretty difficult to figure out, even though I'm used to being under the water and all the guys are. Doing a transect is a little bit of a unique situation for us. But we're able to do it on hookah, so that's a good thing. The other thing that I wanted to make sure to mention was that we had our first abalone advisory group meeting by teleconference, and the participants were Pat Colston, Ian Taniguchi, Maura Leaus from the department, Dr. Daniel Geiger from the Museum of Natural History here, Dr. Paul Dayton, myself, Bill Bernard from consumptive, Captain Habrock, and Chip Bissell, all representing the recreational dive industry. Chris Knight, reef check director, representing non-consumptive, and John Butler and Sean Hastings, with Chris Mobley also participating, representing government agencies, as well as Gary Davis. And it was a constructive first meeting, and we're hoping that, if possible, a commissioner can attend the first face-to-face meeting on September 29th. And the actual location hasn't been determined yet, but it'll be somewhere in Santa Barbara, and it's supposedly going to start at noon. At this point, it's the 29th at noon. It's Friday.
So, I'm on.
Okay, great. Thanks, Commissioner Rogers.
Just let me know where.
And Sonke's participating in next week's survey process. John is participating in the process. So we have a lot of people, and it should be a really fun 5 days if the weather cooperates. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It should. Maybe some wind.
Okay. Next item. Go ahead, Don.
Mr. Gill, just two quick words. For the recreational fishing component, you know, we get up and a lot of times have issue with destructive commercial fishing gear. I just again want to emphasize United Anglers' point of view on this. This is the way it should be done. Compliment Chris Voss for the great job that he's done with the abalone fishery and say, hey, hats off, and we're behind him on this, and thank you for your cooperation on it.
Yeah, I'd like to add something, too, if I may. And that is the department has really, really opened themselves up and is really working diligently with the commercial side of things as well as the expanded advisory group. And I just think that that's the kind of public-private partnership we so desperately need here. And we may be a little flush with budgets right now, but we will not be in the future. This is always the case. And so it's a great thing. More eyes on the water. Guys who now know the protocols for running the transects. I mean, everything is just excellent. Well done, guys. Thank you.
Okay, next, item 10.
All right, thank you. Item 10, receipt of federal agencies' informational items. And I have a speaker card from Chris Mobley, superintendent of the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary.
I know I signed it for you.
Paul, I'm not going to recognize you anymore. You were disruptive in this meeting, and according to the Public Meetings Act, I have that right. You refused to stay on the subject of the agenda item that we were on and refused to relinquish the microphone when I told you to. You're not allowed to speak here anymore today. Thank you.
I did turn in my written comments.
Good afternoon, commissioners, staff, and the department. Welcome to Santa Barbara. Very brief. On August 11th, NOAA released a draft environmental impact statement, which proposes to complete the marine protected area network around the Channel Islands. The draft was released August 11th. The comment period closes October 10th. Public hearings will be in Ventura on September 26th, in Santa Barbara on September 28th. And also at our Sanctuary Advisory Council meeting on September 22nd. The preferred alternative in the document, we did send a copy of the draft to the Commission. The preferred alternative essentially reflects the map that this Commission in 2002 approved in its CEQA document. That CEQA document showed federal closures as well as state, although under state law, only the state portions were implemented in 2003. So this would reflect completing the network, quote-unquote, that was originally supported by this commission through a federal action, a NEPA action. There are three alternatives in there. The other alternatives are no action alternative and then an alternative that would be bigger than what the CEQA process originally preferred to do and what this commission voted on. So in the interim, we've been very heavily involved in the implementation of the existing state network, working with the department, working with the national park on all aspects of implementation, including education and outreach to inform users of the resource on where the closures are and what the rules are, getting the word out, having cooperative enforcement with state park wardens, working with our assets to try and get high compliance, which I'm happy to report compliance has been very high. And then also a fairly extensive research and monitoring program involving many, many partners, our research vessel, our aircraft, and a number of universities and scientists. Hopefully the research program out there will not only tell the story as to what the effect of these closures have had and will continue to have in the Channel Islands, but will also provide a lot of insights and information that will be useful to this body and others in understanding how closures up and down the coast would affect resources. And also, not just the ecology side, but of course the human side, the socioeconomics. What are the impacts on the communities? When we assessed what we thought the worst case scenario impacts would be, you know, were those assessments correct? What kind of adaptive management adjustments might be appropriate now and in the future. So The main thing, though, was to give you a heads up that our draft environmental document is out. We'll be working closely with the department during the comment period to resolve any issues in coordination and making sure that the department and NOAA are on the same page on that. And, of course, during the comment period, we'll be getting input from many different stakeholders, recreational fishermen, commercial fishermen, the community, and, of course, from the Pacific Fishery Management Council and other interested parties. With that, I'll stop unless there's any questions. Thank you.
Any questions or comments?
No, just a comment. Chris, I wanted to thank you for the terrific participation in yesterday's tour out there. I can't speak for Commissioner Gustafson. I imagine she'll do so for herself. But that was a very, very informative tour, John, and thank you for your efforts in organizing. That was excellent.
All right. Thank you very much, and we appreciate it, and we'll continue to work with the department between draft and final. Thanks.
Thank you.
We have one public speaker on that, and that will be Greg Helms from the Ocean Conservancy.
Good afternoon. I'm Greg Helms from the local office of the Ocean Conservancy. I worked quite a bit on the reserves process, both state and federal. A couple points I hope will be kept in mind as this process moves forward. Number one, that the state, your commission and the state at large really has the opportunity to cash in on an existing very effective partnership with the Channel Islands, the park, and the other groups that are involved with this, and that's helped leverage dollars, bring, for example, a socioeconomic researcher and coordinator at the sanctuary, effective enforcement, et cetera, and that's nothing to sneeze at. Secondly, regarding habitats, the Channel Islands is a little different than the process you guys just went through with the MLPA, in that we don't have that the deep kind of subtidal water in the state portion of the Channel Islands, the first 3 miles. This is an opportunity to complete the network in terms of habitat coverage. In fact, that was the focus of the fisherman's alternative that was brought to the sanctuary, really getting in at that Santa Cruz canyon, of which there's a sliver or a wedge, but not the kind of representation we need. That relatively new report by National Marine Fisheries Service, Northwest Service Center, talking about the 41% decline in the mid and deeper water fish, the midwater trawl type fish, over the last 21 years only, really shows us that we're leaving a lot of productivity on the table out in the system. We want to be able to unleash that from fishing pressure in smart, small areas to see if we can get things to go bonkers and begin getting back to a natural size structure and the productivity we know that has. With regard to federal and state work, the council, the sanctuary has been off working very hard with the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, and I want to just bottom line that for you. What has happened is, in the federal waters, you've got sort of one agency or set of agencies that have the concern and the mandate about ecosystem protection. You've got another one that does fisheries management. Strangely enough, here in California, or luckily enough, here in California, you guys, the Fish and Game Commission Department, has both of those functions melded together. Concern about the ecosystems, the non-consumptive enjoyment, and the yield and the management of fisheries. That's separated in federal waters, and we finally, not without some drama and some back and forth, reached a decision where those will be integrated. The fishery management measures where they can be applied to meet the goals of the sanctuary are going to be, and then there's going to be complementary type of additional regulation by the sanctuary to create the whole. That's the kind of seamlessness, the kind of coherence and working together, interagency partnerships that the U.S. Ocean Commission, the Pew Commission talked about, and we're seeing that happen. So we hope that you'll continue to look at that kind of interdisciplinary or interagency role to make these things happen, because it's such a cliche now, the ocean knows no boundaries. The final piece is, this is a model. You've made an investment, and since it precedes the MLPA reserves by that much, it's really your spotlight in the dark, and we hope you'll sort of come at it with that kind of attitude and receive return on your investment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Move on to item 11, receipt of legal counsel informational items.
Now, Mr. President, or in this case, Mr. Kellogg, members of the commission, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General, and your counsel. I did come with a couple of things to talk about, but in looking at our schedule and our commission availability, I'll go ahead and pass on those. I would like to use this opportunity, however, to report out the executive session discussion we had during our lunch break, if that's appropriate. I wanted to point out that during during our lunch, we did have an executive session for the commission. We met. I met with the commission, I as their legal counsel, to discuss several matters in litigation. Those matters are identified on the commission's executive session agenda. We also did talk about items under both categories A and B, and did also talk about category items in category D, which were appeals hearings to the commission. All three of those appeals, those on behalf of Josh Fisher, Carl Wheeler, and Chris Ecobellis, were denied by the commission at this time. And that's all I have to report. Mr. Kellogg.
Thank you, counsel. Any questions, comments from the commissioners? Last item on today's agenda is the consent calendar. I would entertain a motion to...
I move approval.
Second.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Ayes have it, and I'll be the order.
And that's it for today. We start at 8:30 tomorrow.
That's that ends the commission meeting for today. We'll start the restart the commission, well, adjourn recess until tomorrow at 8:30.